Chapter 61. The fall mayor Richard Lucero's office in Española contacted Trish to invite me to spend a day walking in the mayor's shoes, about the 100th time I had heard that expression in New Mexico. I met him at 7:30 a.m. at the Española feed store, Country Farm Supply, that his family owned. He had been mayor on and off for 20 years and was a patron among patrons. I had met him a few times when we both sat on stage at Pete Domenici events. Lucero had the magical charisma of a great leader or successful politician. If he had been born in Texas or Florida, he could have become a governor or senator. In the feed store, Lucero sat on a pile of 40-pound sacks and held court. Except for the rural staging, it was exactly the famous scene in the Godfather movie. People with problems or disputes were ushered into the mayor's presence, and he dispensed solutions or justice. An assistant, a young man, kept notes. One petitioner was behind in his rent and facing eviction. Lucero agreed to fix it with the landlord, but beware if the man didn't catch up on rent by the next month. Another wanted the town to pave the dirt alley behind his house. Lucero would look into it, he said, but suggested that there was not much hope. A mother brought in a new baby for the mayor to, in effect, bless. Lucero drove the two of us around town in his Cadillac. He pointed with pride to the Richard Lucero Public Library and the Richard Lucero Recreation Center, which boasted an Olympic-sized swimming pool. A current project was the construction of a soon-to-be-beautiful Plaza de Española on a dusty square of town land. Already built was a half-scale recreation of Alhambra Gardens in Granada, not yet with water, and near to it, a replica Spanish Misión y Convento, a church, basically. Funding for the project was a gift from Senator Pete Domenici via an earmark on a federal appropriation bill. But this was a source of frustration to Lucero. Since the plaza was to be officially a national historical site, the National Park Service would not allow the church to be consecrated as such. Designated as a museum, it could not be reserved for baptisms, confirmations, weddings, or funerals. "Could the lab do anything to help on the issue?" he asked me. I said that I doubted it. Still walking in the mayor's shoes, I went with him to a party in an Española family's small home. The occasion was a young woman's graduating from high school with honors, and the main cause for celebration, her getting a job as an entry-level admin at the lab. The mayor made sure that I understood what a big deal this was. She would have a reliable income, promotions, a retirement plan, and health insurance. She would be more desirable in marriage, because her husband and children would be covered on her health insurance. The girl was in a frilly party dress and was beaming. The mayor gave her a big hug and implied that she had gotten the job by his influence and good relationship with senior administrators at the lab, now including me, he said pointedly. Only toward the end of my visit, cruising in his Cadillac with the air conditioning going full blast, did Lucero get to the point about what he really wanted from me. Lionel Long had some college scholarship funds to be awarded, based on need, to children of lab employees. I had succeeded, after much bureaucratic to and fro, in getting permission from UC and NNSA to use the money for scholarships for other kids, not necessarily lab families, in the poorer counties bordering the lab. New Mexico politics was involved because, if we found kids for the scholarships, much of the money would flow to the New Mexico universities, UNM in Albuquerque, NM Tech in Socorro, and NM State in Las Cruces. Mayor Lucero was well informed about this, and he didn't like it. "I don't want you to give college scholarships to our children," he told me. All over America, he insisted, small towns were dying because young people were leaving for college and not coming back. His town had a history over four centuries. He had spent the day with me to show me that it was alive and vibrant. It wasn't just the girl who was celebrating, it was her whole extended family, knowing now that she wouldn't be forced economically to move away, and that she would also anchor some lucky boy. "Don't take our children away from us," Lucero said, in some combination of plea and command. He had an alternative in mind. The lab's money should be used to establish a barber college in Española. I gathered that this was something he had already asked Domenici and been turned down. He wanted an answer from me. Patrones could make deals in parked cars and honor them. "Mr. Mayor," I said, "I've learned a lot today. I'm grateful to you, but you have your job, and I have mine. A part of my job is to get smart kids to go to college. I have no choice about this. He gave me a disappointed look and dropped me off at my car. His Cadillac versus my Subaru said it all. In a curious and indirect way, my experience with Mayor Lucero is related to John Brown's final fall from grace. But I need to connect a few more dots. If someone at the lab broke the law, you might think that they would be arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced. Not so simple. Physical security at LANL was provided by a contractor, Protective Technologies of Los Alamos. PTLA was the civilian descendant of the military force that guarded the lab during World War II and beyond through the 1950s. The lab was PTLA's only client. Their people dressed in battle fatigues, carried handguns and automatic weapons, and trained with heavier equipment, armored personnel carriers with machine guns, against the day that the lab might be attacked by terrorists seeking nuclear materials like plutonium. After 9/11, this seemed not quite as fanciful as before. But PTLA was not a police force. They had no power of arrest. The Los Alamos Police Department had no jurisdiction on lab property, and they and the county council wanted to keep it that way. The closest people with power to actually arrest someone on lab property were FBI agents in Albuquerque. This arrangement had sometimes awkward consequences. Every August 6th, the anniversary of Hiroshima, the lab hosted a small nuclear protest, for several years led by the actor Martin Sheen. Hosted is the right word. The day before, we sent a memo to all employees warning that any harassment of peaceful protesters would subject them to disciplinary action. We cleared out the main parking lot in front of the administration building for the protesters' use. We supplied drinking water so that no one would collapse in the heat. PTLA always made an impressive show of force with its line of impassive security officers in battle gear. And importantly, they were all checked and double-checked to be sure that they had no ammunition in their weapons or on their person. One year, Martin Sheen's agent contacted the lab to say that Mr. Sheen wanted to be arrested and that others would surely want to join him. Could we handle that? Of course, Stan Buzzboom was in charge on our side. He caused a bright yellow line to be painted across the parking lot. Any protester who crossed that line would be arrested for trespass. News photographers took pictures of Sheen's crossing the line, falling dramatically to his knees, and being handcuffed with plastic ties by PTLA. No matter that the photographers were themselves freely crossing the line, this was theater. About 30 more people lined up obediently to cross and get handcuffed. They were led to a bus, a borrowed Los Alamos school bus, and driven into town where, to their surprise and distress, they were released. We had tried to get the FBI or the U.S. Marshal to come up from Albuquerque and arrest at least Sheen, as his agent demanded. Wisely, these actual cops wouldn't play. So for petty crimes committed by lab employees on lab property, lab management was in practice judge and jury, with punishments up to and including the possibility of dismissal. This last was a big deal. Mayor Lucero's lessons for me had included the demonstration of the significance to his people of LANL employment. In a $2 billion a year facility situated in a poor rural area, some petty crime was inevitable. Tools or office supplies were sometimes stolen. Money was sometimes missing from office petty cash boxes. Lab purchase, credit cards, used for small items, were sometimes abused. I once estimated, based on cases I had heard about, that the lab lost maybe $100,000 a year on things like this. That might sound like a lot, but out of $2 billion, it amounted to less than 0.01%, and it was kept pretty stable by our catching and firing the occasional bad actor. The idea of arresting and actually prosecuting such people was ridiculous and would have generated ill will in communities such as Lucero's, far beyond any utility. Then Joe Salgado decided, for reasons unclear to me, that we needed to find and dismiss more bad employees. Early in 2002, he created under Busboom and the latter's deputy Gene Tucker, a new investigative unit. If Busboom was a large, unflappable bear, Tucker was a compact, fighting bantam cock. I liked the bear, but didn't much like the rooster. The new investigative unit was staffed by hiring two former cops, in fact, former police chiefs, Glenn Walp, who had been commissioner of the Pennsylvania State Police, and Steve Doran, who had been chief in tiny Idaho City, Idaho, a distant suburb of Boise. That this job was far below Walt's previous one might indicate something about his past. Walt proved to be neither a bear nor a rooster, but an open 5-gallon can of gasoline. Up to this point, I had some direct knowledge of events. After this point, I learned things only much later, not long before the rest of the world did. Less understandable is that John Brown was also kept in the dark by Joe Salgado. But that was consistent with, "I can fix that. Let's not bother John," which I was familiar with. Walp and Doran found petty crime and corruption pretty much everywhere they looked. Some of it was real, some was invented, because potential whistleblowers thought that they would be rewarded, or they just came forward out of spite. In a place as complicated as New Mexico, where everyone hated everyone, there was no shortage of informants. When Walp and Doran took their smoking gun cases to Gene Tucker, he told them not to pursue them. Gene understood the realities of doing business in northern New Mexico, but it was not in his nature, as it might have been in Buzzboom's, to give patient explanations to the two investigators. He just kept throwing them out of his office. Walp and Doran concluded that Tucker, Buzzboom, and Salgado were all covering up the secret truth, that Lionel was rotten to the core. The gasoline was now poured on the floor, needing only a match. That match was lit by Pete Bussolini, a buildings manager with a lab credit card and a love of the great outdoors. Over a period of months, Bussolini acquired with lab funds and hid in an empty bunker in Technical Area 33, 251 hunting knives, 18 pairs of binoculars, sleeping bags, Arctic jackets, hiking boots, Coleman lanterns, battery-operated coolers, and multiple GPS units. It made sense for him to use TA-33 for his stash. It was the most secret area of the lab, miles distant from other areas where some of the most hidden projects were conducted. I had toured some of these activities, authorized not by John Brown, but by my friends in three-letter agencies back in Washington. When I now and then visited TA-33, I wasn't supposed to tell even Trish. Bussolini was undone when he sent a disgruntled underling to TA-33 to collect the stash and drive it to Bussolini's home garage. This larceny amounted to more than $50,000, by anyone's definition, not petty. When Walp and Doran, who seemed to be joined at the hip, took the case to Tucker and Buzzboom, the detectives cannily knew that this one couldn't be covered up. But, surprisingly, Buzzboom took them off the case and ordered them to hand over their investigative records. That was the moment when the match was struck and the lab went up in flames. Although unlike the Cerro Grande fire, this time only figuratively. What might have happened in a more benign universe was this. The lab, through General Counsel Frank Dixon, would take the evidence to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New Mexico and ask them to prosecute, informing UC and NNSA along the way. The assistant U.S. attorney assigned to the case would then work with the Albuquerque FBI office as needed. It would be out of lab hands. What actually happened was this. Walp and Doran went directly to FBI, offered to help them with the investigation on a continuing basis, and incidentally accused Tucker, Buzzboom, and Salgado of a criminal cover-up. Albuquerque FBI was immediately chomping at the bit to once again occupy Lionel in force. For a few days, Salgado and Dixon were able to hold them off. That became impossible when Walp and Doran surfaced an unrelated case where a lab employee attempted to purchase a souped-up $30,000 Ford Mustang from a dealership in Phoenix with a lab purchase card. The charge was instantly declined, so the transaction never happened. The employee said it was a mistake. UC now got into the act by hiring an outside auditing firm to look at all of Lionel's procurement. Not actually a bad thing, but it was Joe Salgado who brought matters to an unfortunate head. He summoned Walp and Doran to his office, and, Dixon advising and Buzzboom loyally at his side, fired the two investigators. The newspapers instantly got the whole story. It is not hard to guess from whom. The Mustang and the 251 hunting knives made for a great read. Christmas in 2002 fell on a Wednesday. Lionel was closed for the whole week, the annual winter energy conservation closure that coincidentally always fell on Christmas week. UC's holiday vacation was already in progress. In this hiatus, UC President Dick Atkinson and UC Vice President for Laboratory Operations John McTague together worked themselves into a state of hysteria. McTague was a UCLA chemist who had done a stint in Reagan's Office of Science and Technology Policy, then 12 years as a senior research manager at Ford Motor Company. His position in UC's Office of the President was a new one, established after Wen-Ho Lee. McTague liked to talk tough. I think he learned that at Ford, but he probably knew no more about operations than I did, and almost surely less than I did about operations in northern New Mexico. Buried in UC's management contract for the Los Alamos and Livermore labs was a standard clause in all federal contracts. The government could cancel the contract at any time, immediately, for convenience. Historically, the federal government canceled contracts for convenience almost never. At Los Alamos, doing so would leave 12,000 workers immediately unemployed, not to mention plutonium and tritium facilities, among others, unattended. It just couldn't happen. If NNSA actually wanted to yank the contract, it would take months of negotiations for an orderly transition. Nevertheless, Atkinson and McTague convinced each other that a termination for convenience was imminent. Somehow, they got the idea that Secretary of Energy Spencer Abraham would make the announcement on January 2nd, the first working day of the new year. Vacation week notwithstanding, they felt a need to act before then. 2 days before Christmas, Atkinson called Brown and fired him, later reported as Brown calling Atkinson to say that he intended to resign. Former directors of national laboratories normally move to senior scientist positions, with opportunities to advise and mentor. Here, the deal offered, rumor, as I later heard it, was ugly. Brown was told to literally get himself and his family out of town within 2 months. If he did so, UC would pay him a reduced salary for some period in residence on a UC campus. Implied was that, if he resisted, UC would terminate his employment immediately, for cause. John agreed to pack up and leave. The day after Christmas, he called us set members individually with the news. Secretary Abraham had been informed. Brown's resignation was announced in an all-hands memo on January 2nd. Salgado was fired by McTague. There was some later dispute about exactly when. Busboom and Tucker couldn't be summarily fired. We on the seat were at-will employees, but people below the associate director level could be fired only after a lengthy procedure. They negotiated individual settlements to leave the lab. Brown eventually cut all ties with UC, and as an independent consultant, later served on a series of high-level advisory boards. Joanne Milam escaped anyone's notice. She arranged to transfer herself to some far corner of the lab. She and I kept in contact. I asked her how Joe could have been so stupid as to fire Walp and Doran, and why she didn't stop him. It was a pissing match among 3X cops, she said. There was nothing I could do. I was left untouched by these events, except that suddenly I was working for the new acting laboratory director. He was Vice Admiral Peter Nanos, USN, RET. Chapter 62, Nanos. Who was this Vice Admiral? George P. Pete Nanos, whom I now worked for. Conveniently for UC's Atkinson and McTague in their rush to fire John Brown, Nanos was already at Los Alamos and on the University of California payroll, and he was a retired Navy admiral with a reputation for toughness. John Brown had hired Pete to direct the lab's global security division 6 months before, just after Pete left the Navy. Division director was a job well below the status of an admiral. It was generally thought that Pete would in due course succeed Don Cobb as, more suitably, an associate laboratory director. Nanos was a U.S. Naval Academy graduate, class of 1967. After a tour at sea, he had qualified for the Navy's highly selective Burke program, which sent young officers to get graduate degrees at elite universities. Pete moved to Princeton and, in the 2 years that the program allowed, got a PhD in physics. My Jason colleague, Kurt Callen, remembered him from that time 30 years earlier. Rising through the ranks, Nanos checked the required boxes for duty at sea, but his career was mainly on shore, in acquisition and procurement. He did a tour as the head of acquisition of submarine ballistic missiles. His final command, which came with promotion to three-star admiral, was leading naval sea systems. NAVSEA, so-called, had 20,000 employees and a procurement budget of $23 billion. This all seemed promising. Nanos appointed Rich Marquez to fill the deputy director position vacated by Salgado. Marquez, a skillful bureaucrat, had worked 20 years in DOE, then come to LANL as associate director for administration. although he reported to Salgado, he had somehow remained untouched by the latter's downfall. The rest of the senior executive team was as it had been. Pete assured us that we, the survivors, were not part of the problem that he had been brought in to fix. Indeed, he met more often with the full set and associate laboratory directors than John Brown had done, another good sign. And yet, the meetings with Pete were strange affairs. We soon learned that free-form discussion was not tolerated. We spoke when spoken to. We sat in our seats. Nanos typically jumped out of his seat and strode around the table, pointing at people and giving orders, some of which made sense, others not. He appointed Judith Kay as his executive chief of staff, a title that had not before existed. Judith had previously been some kind of HR representative to the director's office, but she was now Pete's executive officer on all matters, including technical issues far beyond her capability. She wrote down everything Pete said if it sounded like an order, and then followed up to ensure our individual compliance. It was hard to know when to comply and when to ignore. If, in response to my mention of some long-standing activity, Pete said, "I don't like that," did it mean that I was supposed to terminate it forthwith? Judith often thought so. If I ignored something that Pete actually wanted and remembered, I sometimes got an email from him ordering me to produce weekly reports on the subject until advised otherwise. I would do so for 6 or 7 weeks and then stop, which always went unnoticed. Since most issues that I worked had timescales of months or even years, most of my weekly reports were status same as last week, although I often dressed this up in bureaucraties. Then there were excursions beyond the strange to the completely bizarre. Once, striding around the table, Nano stopped, pointed his finger at Don Cobb, and shouted, "You shithead! If I don't see an immediate improvement, then you're fucking out of here!" We all, including Don, sat dumbfounded. The preceding discussion had not even been about Don or his programs. It took us some further moments to realize that this wasn't about Don at all. Pete's outburst was supposed to be, as it were, in quotes. He was demonstrating for us the kind of forceful leadership that he thought was lacking at Lionel. As director, Pete had ample opportunities to make such demonstrations, perhaps minus the obscenities, in many forums at the lab and in town. And he did. Within a year, he had become the most hated man in Los Alamos County. At public events in town, where John Brown had always been surrounded by well-wishers and petitioners, Pete was shunned. I took note of an intermission at one of the town's well-subscribed classical music concerts. Half of the lobby was crowded with people chatting. In the other half were Pete, his wife, and his aging mother, whom he doted on, and a vast, empty space. Vandals planted for sale signs in his front yard, hoping that he would take the hint. It was reported that, fearing for his mother's welfare, he had a safe room installed in his house. The contrast with John Brown could not have been starker. When I had traveled with John on his regular TWA flights to Washington, ticket agents and flight attendants greeted him by name and with big hugs. The lab received confidential quarterly reports from its pharmacy benefits manager, listing in aggregate the drugs most frequently prescribed for lab employees. Allergy medicines were always near the top of the list. Under Nanos, there was a sharp increase in antidepressants. In my work in Washington, I had interacted with, worked with, many active duty and retired 3- and 4-star flag officers. They were an impressive group, thoughtful people who radiated a calm quality of leadership. Pete Nanos was completely different. But for two ball bearings, he might have been Captain Queeg in the Kane Mutiny novel. I was still on the board of the Institute for Defense Analyses and asked its new president, recently retired Admiral Dennis Blair, if he knew Nanos. He said he did. I described some of Pete's behavior. "Why does Pete seem to know nothing about leadership?" I asked. Denny said, "Well, Nanos, he's not really an admiral." I wasn't sure I understood him. "Oh, you mean he's not a 4-star?" Denny had led the U.S. Pacific Command, a 4-star position. Nanos had retired with 3 stars. Denny said, "No, that's not what I mean. He came up through procurement. He never had a real at-sea command. In my book, he's not an admiral." One-on-one meetings with Pete were also strange. He heard exactly what he wanted to hear. Everything else seemed to pass over or through him and be lost. It was just like my ex-wife Margaret's description of her friend, the incarcerated serial killer Tom Maimone. Okay, so I have to explain that Pete Nanos was not a serial killer, as far as I knew, and that Maimone was not exactly Margaret's friend. She had gotten to know him while writing a true crime book about his case, and he called her once a year to sit beside him and testify at his parole board hearing. "Should this man be released?" she would be asked. "Absolutely not," she would say. "He's a hyper-intelligent psychopath who, I think, will likely kill again." After the hearing, Maimone would thank Margaret for her praise. Of what she said, the only thing that registered was that she thought him hyper-intelligent. The next year, he would ask her again to testify. The admins in the director's office all hated both Pete and Judith Kay, so unless those two kept a matter strictly between them, it was soon known to all the other admins and thereafter their bosses. In April 2004, Trish told me that Judith was working for Pete on a secret project, a complete shuffling of the set-level org chart. In their secret current draft, there was no deputy director for science and technology, but only a chief science officer with very limited responsibilities. That would be me, obviously. It was by now obvious to me that Pete would himself eventually be fired. It was only a matter of time. No director could survive the hatred and disloyalty that he had brought upon himself, and I couldn't imagine that a third director, after Brown and Nanos, would want to keep me as a deputy after I had been so close to these two imploding bosses. I had stuck with Nanos for more than a year, but now it was time for me to get out. I prepared carefully. I told Trish the plan. I located John Brown's letter, specifying that that lab would support my continuing as a senior scientist. On a pretext, since director's office calendars were visible to Judith Kay and others, Trish scheduled Sally Keller, my 9/11 war buddy and statistics group leader, to come to my office. "I'm stepping down," I told Sally. "No one knows except Trish, Jeffrey, and now you. I need to burrow far, far down in the lab. I need a safe house. Can I join your group?" Pete Miller had once explained to me that Lanell's groups were its indestructible atoms. Higher management might create or destroy divisions and shuffle groups around within them, but it was next to impossible for them to much affect a group's inner workings. This was a fact of management not unique to the LNL. First-line managers everywhere tend to be more loyal to their own people than to the management chain above them. The statistics group was a particularly indestructible atom. Existing since the Manhattan Project, it had bounced around among divisions and was currently lodged in an applied division that did mostly reactor safety simulations. Sally easily met payroll for her people by providing their services to projects all over the lab, with the result that she was responsible pretty much to no one. In fact, her growing budget was funding a hiring spree. "We do have office space for you," Sally said, "but can you bring some director's office money with you for office furniture?" We consulted Trish, who said that she could arrange this without leaving any fingerprints, hers, mine, or anyone else's. Once my new furniture was safely ordered, I went in to see Pete. I showed him Brown's letter. "I'm really a scientist at heart," I told him, trying to sound meek and academic. I reminded him that I had been a manager now for 5 years. "Working for him was a privilege," I said, "but I wanted to get back to research. I felt that I had more to contribute to LNL as a scientist." Pete read the letter and stood up from his desk. He pointed his finger at me as he had done Don Cobb. "You're a rat," he shouted. "You're a rat leaving a sinking ship. I won't let you get away with that. I'm going to make sure that you drown." I had not previously credited Pete with this degree of self-awareness about his own leadership, let alone easy command of nautical metaphor. I responded that no, this had nothing to do with any external events. It was just time for me to be a scientist again. "You're fired," Pete screamed. "I'm going to leave you with no salary, effective today. I'm going to call security and have you escorted off the premises." Now this was scary, except that Pete didn't actually pick up the phone or do anything. Backing out of his office like a courtier in the presence of an angry emperor, I expressed the obsequious hope that he would reconsider before taking any such action. The encounter had not gone as I had expected. Back at my office, I called John Byerly on his cell phone. John was a sensible LNL manager who had moved to UC Office of the President as McTague's deputy. Through Jason interactions, I had known him for years. Your director here has gone berserk, I said, as calmly as I could, but noticing that my voice was quavering. My message to Barely, as my friend, was that unlike in the case of John Brown, I was not going to go quietly. I mentioned the reporters at Science and Nature whom I talked to regularly, and that Sandy Blakesley, the New York Times science reporter who lived in Santa Fe, was a good friend of Jeffrey's and mine. I said that my goal wasn't to smear Pete. It was unnecessary. He would collapse under his own incompetence. No, I was going to smear the University of California for their treatment of me as a senior scientist, Harvard professor, former, and NAS member. I suggested that Byerly take my message directly to UC President Dick Atkinson, not to McTague. Atkinson knew me pretty well, and he would fold, whereas McTague, playing the tough guy, might have some crazy idea of backing Pete. Byerly agreed with this assessment. At Lionel, I went to see Rich Marquez, the only member of the set who ever seemed able to influence Nanos. I couldn't make the comparison at the time, but I later came to see Marquez as a kind of New Mexico version of Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell served Henry VIII effectively and with invisibly much greater freedom of action than he ever let on. He could make things happen without leaving traces. Marquez was the same. By now my voice was steadier, and I related my conversation with Byerly. This can all be made to go away by Pete's simply honoring John Brown's letter, I said to Rich. I'll see what I can do, he said without emotion. For a few nervous days I heard nothing. Then Byerly sent me a draft letter for comment. I would be appointed a senior fellow, the highest rank of scientist, but my manager-level salary would be immediately cut by 25%. I would get 3 years of research support, but I would promise to leave the lab after that time. Pete won't go any farther than this, Byerly said. I didn't think it was actually Pete. The letter had Marquez's non-fingerprints all over it. This was as far as he could go for me without angering his boss. Except for its trashing of John Brown's promises, it was not too bad an outcome. The promise to leave the lab was meaningless, because I was sure that Pete would not be there in 3 years. I accepted the terms. Within days, I moved to my new senior scientist corner office, with new office furniture out of nowhere, in distant building 1402, where Sally's group was housed. Everyone around me had PhDs in statistics. I was suddenly classified as a statistician, another unlikely career shift. The role of statistician will be performed henceforth by William H. Press. A few weeks after I was there, when I was starting to get to know my new colleagues, a young scientific staff member came into my office. May I shut the door? She said. Then, privately, I want to ask about your experience in management. I know what Sally does as group leader, and I think I understand some of what Sally's boss, the D division leader, does. But you were three levels above that. What do you people on the fourth floor of the admin building actually do? She wasn't being sarcastic. She was genuinely curious. I thought about my previous 5 years of 10-hour days, filled with back-to-back appointments, the crises, the prayer wheels and windmills, and rare strategic accomplishments. As much as I wanted to answer my now colleague, it struck me that we had no common vocabulary on the issue. Nothing done on the fourth floor could actually sound significant to an ambitious early career research scientist. It's exactly what you think, I said eventually. We all get big salaries for just pushing paper around. We don't really do anything. She left, satisfied with the truth. A month after I left the sinking USS Nanos, the lab had a bad week. A student's retina was scarred by a laser beam. Her supervisor inexcusably didn't enforce the wearing of safety goggles, and in a different part of the lab, an inventory of classified computer media indicated that two floppy disks were missing. Both incidents could have been dealt with by normal processes. The student's supervisor would be deservedly fired, and was in fact. The floppy disks would be found to not actually exist, a clerical error in tracking pre-numbered labels. But instead of normal process, Pete shut down the whole lab and summoned all scientists to a meeting in the auditorium at which he ranted, Queeg-like, about cowboys and buttheads who thought they were above the rules. In an all-employees memo, he wrote, I don't care how many people I have to fire to make it stop. If you think the rules are silly, if you think compliance is a joke, please resign now and save me the trouble. In a press conference, he talked about a culture of arrogance and the suicidal denial loose at the lab. Scientists, including me, were ordered to do a punitive long week of ineffective video safety training. Crafts workers, electricians, plumbers, etc., who were mostly independent contractors and mostly Hispanic, were told to report every day to the parking lot of Los Alamos High School, and if they wanted to get paid, stand around in the hot sun for 8 hours. There were no restrooms, and no water was provided. Some lab activities were shut down for months. I knew from my DuPont-style safety training under John Brown, this was exactly how not to produce individual responsibility for an effective safety or security culture. The U.S. Government Accountability Office later estimated that Pete's actions cost taxpayers $370 million. Byerly later told me that after these events, Atkinson and McTaig wanted Pete gone. But this time, to avoid looking so panicked, they gave him time, and they used their influence to find him a position elsewhere. It took almost a year to find a place willing to take him. In May 2005, Pete abruptly resigned as Los Alamos director to become one of several associate directors at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency in Washington. I want to loop back for a moment with further color on Denny Blair, whose only connection to my Nano saga was his expressed belief that Pete's three stars didn't make him a real admiral. Denny was a man consumed with a sense of honor, of which he had considerable self-awareness. He once told me, by way of explanation, that he was a sixth-generation naval officer. His great-great-great-grandfather was at sea aboard a U.S. Navy ship when a passing ship gave them the news that Fort Sumter had been attacked. The Civil War begun. The captain called his officers together. "If any of you cannot support the Union, I will let you ashore at a neutral port. Everyone else must now take an oath to support the United States Constitution." "I cannot take such an oath," Denny's ancestor is supposed to have said, "because I took that oath when I became an officer, and no gentleman should ever be asked to take the same oath twice." He departed the ship and left the Union Navy. Denny felt a strong kinship to this ancestor of his. Blair was eased out as IDA president in 2007 after he got into an extended semi-public pissing match with Senator John McCain, another retired admiral, on, yes, a point of honor. McCain opposed continuing the troubled F-35 fighter acquisition and criticized an IDA report for recommending otherwise, implying incorrectly that Blair had a financial conflict of interest. That besmirched Denny's honor, and he fired back at McCain personally. John White, a member of the IDA board and former Deputy Secretary of Defense, called every board member individually. "Denny has every right to defend his honor," White said to each of us, "but not as CEO of a not-for-profit DoD analysis center. He has to choose which is more important to him." White worked patiently until he had unanimous agreement of the board. Given a choice between honor, as he saw it, and a practical duty to IDA as the board saw it, Denny chose to resign. This was the first and only time I ever witnessed a corporate board acting independently and at odds with management for the actual good of the company. I thought White a hero. Blair became Director of National Intelligence under President Obama in 2009. When he resigned the position in 2010, and it was reported that he had gotten into a pissing match with Obama officials John Brennan and Leon Panetta, I wasn't surprised. As for Nanos, a decade after I had left Los Alamos for Austin, as we'll be told, I encountered Pete at a Jason cocktail reception. He greeted me warmly. He told me that he had been sorry when I decided to step down from management and go back to science. He was glad that my research at the lab, with his support, had worked out. It was once again spookily, like Margaret's serial killer Maimone. Pete assimilated and retained only his own rosy version of events. Chapter 63. Innocence Abroad, CISAC, the Committee on International Security and Arms Control of the National Academy of Sciences, was formed in 1980 as a vehicle for so-called Track 2 exchanges with Soviet scientist policymakers. Track 1 exchanges are defined as government to government. Track 2 exchanges involve private individuals, but with the light cognizance of their respective governments. Unsurprisingly, CSAC's roster included many of the older generation of Jasons, Pief Panofsky, Murph Goldberger, Dick Garwin, Josh Lederberg, Charlie Towns, along with others in this same generation of Cold War arms control technocrats, Paul Doty, Al Flax, Spurgeon Keeney, Jack Ruina. Most CSAC members were NAES members, but others were drafted from the larger policy world. That CSAC achieved some traction and success, generally behind the scenes, was partly due to a quirk of the way that Soviet science was organized. Their Academy of Sciences, Akademie Nauk SSSR, was vastly more powerful than our NAS. Most funding for science, and much for applied technology, was channeled through ANSSR, making it the equivalent of our NAS, NSF, DOE, DARPA, and the military service labs, all combined. ANSSR was the technology bedrock of the Soviet military-industrial establishment. Academicians, who sat on the Soviet side of the table in exchanges with CSAC, were powerful people with direct lines into the Kremlin. Some were Supreme Soviet members themselves. It was a convenient pretense to consider them non-governmental and able to engage in Track 2 exchanges with our National Academy. That all changed with the end of the Soviet Union, and especially with the rise to power of Putin, who had little respect or use for the entrenched ex-Soviet scientific establishment. ANSSR was rechartered as the Russian Academy of Sciences, RAS, with much diminished portfolio and prestige. CSAC continued to hold exchanges with RAS academicians. Raymond Junlows, a materials scientist and my contemporary in Jason and NAS, became CSAC chair, but the older generation of members still dominated the meetings. By the mid-2000s, my view was that CSAC had become an obsolete forum where out-of-influence, aging arms controllers, Russian and American, could talk nostalgically about the good, bad old days. I didn't keep this opinion to myself and casually bad-mouthed CSAC whenever the subject came up. The perhaps foreseeable result was that Bill Colglazier, NAS's executive officer, essentially its COO, asked me to join an upcoming CSAC delegation to Moscow in January 2005. This particular meeting was problematic on several counts. The American delegates, led by Rose Gottemuller and including Dan Poneman, Ord Kittry, and Bill Burns Sr., were career professionals in nuclear weapons non-proliferation. However, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs had suddenly declared weapons non-proliferation to be off-limits for this forum. Instead, discussion would be limited to nuclear power reactor safety, an engineering discipline with few policy implications, and in which the U.S. delegation had no expertise. A second problem was that no NAS member of CSAC was willing to travel to Moscow in January on short notice. This put the Academy in the awkward position of sponsoring a formal delegation that had no NAS members and over which it had almost no influence. Rose in particular was thought to be an entirely well-intentioned but unguided missile. Her actual employer, as she waited out the Republican administration, was the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a think tank that maintained an office in Moscow. She spoke Russian fluently, had once lived in Moscow for 2 years as a Russian studies postdoc. Rose's loyalty to the United States was not in question. It was her loyalty to the National Academy of Sciences that Colglazier doubted. I was to go to Moscow, represent NAS interests, keep an eye on Rose and the others, and report back to Colglazier whether I still thought that CSAC was useless. In short, I was a kind of Academy spy. I had last been in Moscow more than 25 years before, an historical eternity. Russia's GDP plummeted after the fall of the USSR, bottoming in 2000 at a third of its pre-dissolution value. By 2005, under Putin, it had recovered to more than the pre-dissolution value and was growing rapidly. Signs of poverty were still everywhere, but literal signs of wealth, that is, billboards advertising luxury goods, were everywhere. When I had last seen the Central Department Store Gum, it was a dirty warren of threadbare shops. Now it had a Cartier, a Bulgari, a Black Gamma, a Gucci and Hermes, Louis Vuitton, Piaget, Prada, Rolex, and on, luxury goods for the wealthiest tenth or hundredth of a percent. I wondered how this could be a stable situation, how Putin, despite his taming of the oligarchs, could possibly stay in power. Our meetings with the Russians were as bad as I had imagined. The Russian delegation included a couple of academicians with credentials in nuclear safety and a minder from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Vladimir Rybachenkov, whose job was to be sure that we accomplished nothing. There was indeed a lot of Cold War nostalgia. When the name Sagdiv came up in our discussions, he was referred to by the Russians, dryly, as the American physicist Sagdeev. Since I had known Sagdeev 25 years earlier as the director of the Soviet Space Sciences Institute, IKI, he had defected to the U.S., married Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of the president, and was now living in Maryland. Much more interesting than our formal sessions was accompanying Rose around Moscow when she called on her many professional acquaintances, some going back a generation to when she was that cute young Russian studies scholar. As she had advanced in government, so had her old Russian friends. Some were high in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, literally and figuratively. The MFA's huge edifice, one of the seven Stalinist skyscrapers, could not but impress. None of these courtesy calls could be described as substantive, but if diplomacy had the aim of keeping open channels of communication, then Rose, suffering through many lingering bear hugs, was a fine diplomat. I reported as much back to Bill Colglazier, along with my assessment that CSAC as such seemed useless. He responded by having me appointed to a 6-year term on it. Separately from the Russia exchange, CSAC maintained a dialogue with China that was informally termed Track 1.5. Its promotion from Track 2 was in recognition of the fact that anyone worth talking to in China was a government or party official, effectively for life. The Chinese nuclear weapons elder statesmen valued this exchange enough to set up a dummy organization, the Chinese Scientists Group on Arms Control, CSGAC, that, as an arm of the party, rather than the government, was technically non-governmental. Even arms control was a fiction, because China was not a party to any significant arms control treaty, nor was likely ever to be. If CSAC's Russia exchange was a meeting of mostly irrelevant arms controllers given over to nostalgia, its China exchange, while not free of nostalgia, was a meeting of still somewhat relevant nuclear physicist warriors, led on the Chinese side by General Qian Shaojun, the father of Chinese nuclear weapons, and whose side, he who had so visibly and ambiguously made a show of embracing Wenho Li on his visit to Los Alamos. Over the years, Hu had become good friends with Dick Garwin, Harold Agnew, and others in U.S. weapons circles. In fall 2008, I traveled to Beijing with the CSAC delegation, my first trip to China. It was CSAC staff director Micah Lowenthal's idea that I give a talk on cybersecurity, implicitly to push the idea that the China dialogue should be broadened beyond nuclear. A similar effort was being made in biosecurity. The Chinese nuclear warriors knew nothing about cyber and cared less. My talk, bombed. Cratered? My American colleagues explained, "You inject an idea into the Chinese establishment. It seems to disappear, but in reality it is rattling around inside somewhere in the bureaucracy. Later, some transformed version of the idea pops back out. In this case, it took 5 years. In 2011, CSGAC suggested, on their own, that a cybersecurity dialogue be established. Even then, it took 2 more years before an actual meeting in Beijing took place. Given Qian's and Hu's stated ambivalence about cyber, we didn't want to drag on to 14-hour flights across the Pacific the real Washington-U.S. experts, retired military and NSA officials, for what might turn out to be no more than a Chinese propaganda exercise. Our CSAC delegation was thus visibly anemic. MIT computer scientist Dave Clark, NAS staffer Herb Lin, and I were the claimed cyber experts, augmented by Dick Garwin, as self-declared expert on everything, and Ian Johnston, a Harvard government professor, fluent in Mandarin, whose field of academic study was the Chinese People's Liberation Army, PLA. Had we known, we would have done better. Qian and Hu had used their prestige and influence to reach across bureaucratic lines in the party and PLA, rounding up a set of people whom we judged to be high-level managers in China's equivalent of NSA. That was Ian's assessment of who they were, anyway. China did not admit to having any NSA equivalent, and cyber functions, offensive and defensive, were spread, unacknowledged, across several PLA organizations. Kong Tiesheng and Liu Shuiqui gave their affiliations as Expert of Defense Ministry. Ian, mining the Chinese language internet, found that Kong was a senior engineer in the PLA General Staff's 3rd Department, SIGINT and InfoSec, Liu in the 4th Department, Electronic Countermeasures and Signals Processing. Zhao Gang and Zhu Xiaohui, whose affiliation was Beijing Institute of System Engineering, seemed involved in classified research. Call, Xu Weidi, and Dr. Bak, Su Jinshu were academics from the Chinese National Defense University. Their open use of titles only emphasized the fact that the others' military ranks or titles were obscured. General Qian presided formally over the meetings. He remained uninterested in cyber and occasionally napped in his seat. But his presence provided, by his rank and party connections, the top cover necessary for the others in the room to be talking to us at all. Before my time, the CSAC-CSGAC exchanges had alternated between Beijing and Washington. As U.S.-China relations deteriorated, Wenho Li's prosecution one example, and when the U.S. started requiring fingerprints on entry, China forbade its high military officials from traveling to the United States. Hence, all the meetings on my watch were in China, all but one in Beijing. Colonel Su, an affable man with a perfectly idiomatic command of English, attached himself to me at the banquet dinners. His early career postings, before CNDU, were unmistakably those of an intelligence case officer. Ian told me that Xu was a fixture in international exchanges and was not taken very seriously by other Chinese. I couldn't tell whether Xu was assigned to me because the Chinese had assessed me to be a spook, or whether he had decided that he and I were the two wild cards in the group. Xu poked fun at my handling chopsticks like a four-year-old, holding them too close to the tips, but gave me his sophisticated analysis of China's position re-DPRK, North Korea. Briefly, China was little concerned about DPRK nuclear weapons because the Kim dynasty's survival was entirely dependent on Chinese largesse, the flow of oil, for example. What China did fear was the regime collapsing into anarchy with an unstoppable flood of millions of Korean refugees across its border. China was therefore prepared to prop up the DPRK regime indefinitely, especially if it tightly controlled internal population movement. And, he didn't add, if it continued to be a burr under the U.S. saddle. Edward Snowden's WikiLeaks revelations about the U.S.'s ability to vacuum up communications worldwide happened just days before this 2013 meeting, and the Chinese had not yet fully assimilated their import. That was not the case in our subsequent, roughly annual meetings in Beijing. In later years, the U.S. delegation was upgraded by the addition of Linton Brooks, a former ambassador to Russian arms control talks, and for 5 years the U.S. nuclear weapons czar in DOE, retired Admiral Richard Meese, who had commanded all U.S. strategic forces, and Chris Inglis, recently retired deputy director of NSA. More on Inglis later. One of the Academy's more controversial international exchanges was with Iran. Despite the fact that the United States had, since 1980, no diplomatic relations with Iran, and despite a 1995 trade embargo, NAS staffer Glenn Schweitzer had managed to establish an annual exchange between Iranian and American scientists that was now, in 2009, in its 10th year. Meetings had been in Tehran, because the United States would not issue visas to Iranian scientists, and were rendered grudgingly legal by an export license from the U.S. State Department. Just talking to Iranian scientists was considered an export that, without a license, would violate the embargo. The annual choice of subject alternated between the countries, and it was always non-controversial. Arid agriculture and earthquake-resistant construction were typical. A year before the 2009 meeting, however, the Iranians surprised Schweitzer with their choice of topic, the political misuses of science. The mandate for this came from high in the conservative Ahmadinejad administration, he was told. It was a transparent attempt to embarrass the United States. A 2004 report by the Union of Concerned Scientists that detailed the Bush administration's censorship and misuse of science in areas such as climate and reproductive health, abortion, had circulated widely in Iran. If this was their intended purpose, the Iranians' timing turned out to be not so good. In the intervening year, Barack Obama was elected president. One of his first executive orders, thanks to science advisor John Holdren, set in motion a process for new standards of scientific integrity in government. Meanwhile, Iran had been caught out for failing to declare new secret nuclear facilities to the International Atomic Energy Agency. And not exactly a misuse of science, but in the same vein, Iran's 2009 national elections had been visibly rigged to guarantee the re-election of Ahmadinejad over the more liberal Mousavi, this resulting in an aftermath of protests and arrests of students and prominent intellectuals in the more liberal urban areas. In this political climate, Schweitzer, visiting Tehran to firm up details, was himself detained and questioned by elements of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. The upcoming meeting was quickly moved from Iran to France, to be hosted by the French Academy of Sciences at a private estate in Provence. Glenn described this all to me and asked me on short notice to chair the American delegation. The estate in Tour of the Fondation des Trées, a charitable spin-off of the Schlumberger fortune, was about an hour's drive from Nice Airport in an area of olive groves and lavender fields. There, a main building hosted meeting and dining facilities. Participants were housed in smaller, rustic outbuildings, each with two or three bedrooms off a common area. Our delegation included Cy Goodman, International Affairs and Cyber Policy, Kimberly Gray, Energy and Environment, Norm Neureiter, then at AAAS, the figurative dean of international science exchanges, biologists Tim Stearns and Harvey Rubin, Tim, my Jason colleague, Schweitzer, and me. The Iranian delegation comprised three academics and two clerics. The academics were delegation head Reza Rustazad, vice president for research, later chancellor of Sharif University, the Iranian MIT. Sharif was known to the U.S. intelligence community as a hub for the covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. Perhaps for that reason, our export license forbade us to discuss nuclear issues, a boundary that we may have stretched. Mehdi Bahadurinejad was a mechanical engineer at Sharif. Bagher Larijani was a physician and highly placed administrator at Tehran University of Medical Sciences. Larijani's greater claim to fame was as one of five brothers, all at times in government, who were sometimes called the Kennedy brothers of Iran. The family was known as influential, secularly conservative, but not populist or fundamentalist, and adaptive to the changing winds. The clerics, who dressed in their full mullah outfits, were Mohsen Javadi from Qom University, a conservative institution in the holy center of Shiite fundamentalism, and Hamid Shariari, whose stated position was with the National Textbook Authority. Javadi was a kind of philosopher of science. Shariari, it turned out, was a computer scientist. He was responsible for the governance and censorship of the Iranian internet. All the Iranians spoke excellent English. A sixth delegation member, Ahmed Fazaili, would have represented the Secretariat of the Supreme Cultural Revolution Council, but he was denied a visa by the French government as a terrorist. The French Academy, on short notice, had put together a delegation that included medical researcher Patrice Binder, neuroscientist Henri Korn, and physicist Guy Laval. At the welcoming dinner, and contrary to exhortations that we should all mix, the Iranians all sat at one table. I sat down with them and indicated that Tim and Glenn should join me. Bottles of French wine were on the sideboard. I retrieved one and poured for us three Americans. "You cannot sit at this table if you are going to drink wine," Shahriari said. He was the more militant of the two clerics. "I'm not aware of such a rule," I said brightly. "Yes," he said, "it is like a no-smoking zone, but for drinking." "You are absolutely right," I said, "and every table is divided into two zones, drinking and non-drinking. Please let me know if anyone attempts to introduce alcohol into your zone at this or any other table, and I will help you to enforce the rule." My colleagues waited for the escalation of a religious war that would scuttle the whole conference. But what actually happened was that Shahriari nodded, and we were thenceforth best friends, with a long dinner conversation about Iranian politics. Why did Ahmadinejad seem so bellicose? Answer, his rural populist constituency. Why Iran was, in Shahriari's view, such a happy, peaceful country. Why Shia was a religion that valued reason and science, while Sunnis in Iraq and Saudi Arabia were all ignorant barbarians, and so forth. I don't think the Iranians had assembled in advance to assign talking points, but during the week's meetings, formal and informal, they seemed to converge on a small number of them. Shia versus Sunni was a major one for the clerics, whose sophistication the Americans repeatedly underestimated. At a formal session, Harvey Rubin went off script to goad them. "Do you agree that truth is found in the results of replicable scientific experiments?" "Yes, of course," they said. "We are scientists." "But you believe that the Quran is the literal word of God?" "Yes, of course," they said. "So," Harvey continued, thinking that he had them cornered, "if a physics experiment gave results that directly contradicted the Quran, which would you believe?" The two mullahs looked at each other and smiled, then turned to Rubin. "Why the physics experiment, of course?" Harvey was dumbfounded. Javadi looked to be the cat that ate the canary. It turned out that he had published a paper on exactly this in a Western philosophy journal. He launched into a patient explanation. God gave man three gifts: faith, Islam, reason, including experimental science, and revelation, the Quran. For a man of faith, any apparent contradiction between science and the Quran was a no more than a challenge for him to use reason to seek a more refined interpretation of the Quran. It was just that simple. "Of course, the Sunnis don't believe in reason," he said darkly, adding, "especially the Salafis." The Iranian academicians steered clear of religious dogma, but they had a secular version of the same talking point. What a tragedy, in their view, that in the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, the United States had implicitly sided with Sunni Arabs, the then ruling Iraqis, instead of with Iran, a vastly more developed nation, an heir to a great Persian civilization. Theirs was an argument that conveniently ignored the Iran hostage crisis of 1979-81. And why did we now side with Saudi Bedouins, who were even less civilized than the Iraqis were? Another interaction with the mullahs was their explaining to Henry Korn and me, while Larijani listened aloofly, the 8 precise steps of religiosity, number 8 being approximately sainthood. "These people have a great future as Talmudic scholars," Korn whispered to me during the sermon. I agreed. They reminded me of rabbis, seemingly tolerant but pedantically insistent. Korn was a Polish Jew who, as a child, escaped the Holocaust by being sent to live with a Catholic French family. The Iranians seemed to have no awareness of the fact that about half of the French and American delegations were Jewish. In a perfect Islamic state, what step of religiosity do you think an Iranian scientist needs to be at? I asked. Larijani interrupted. He had a squeaky, high-pitched voice that reminded me of Ed Witten, and said pointedly, "Step 1 is more than sufficient." "But not step 0, Shahriari insisted. Larijani shot him a dirty look, and it was the end of the conversation. A second repeated Iranian talking point was on the legitimacy of a theocratic system of government where absolute power vested in a religious supreme leader. One version of this was, "Your government derives its legitimacy from a piece of paper signed by Thomas Jefferson. Our government derives its legitimacy from God. How can you say that yours is better?" Larijani's subtler approach was a statistics-filled talk showing that Iran's medical research and medical education system was modern, emphasized medical ethics and patient-centered care, and despite its being culturally appropriate, he never mentioned the word Islamic, ended up within accepted norms of the West, even on issues like abortion, end of life, consent to treatment. He had to tiptoe around the latter issue because women were subject to permission from fathers or husbands. Still, his point was that we should not to equate theocracy with backwardness, except in the case of the Saudis, of course. Please see talking point number 1. Shahriari was less convincing on this point in talking about internet censorship. "You already censor child pornography," he reminded us. "You put people in jail for having it on their computers. We're no different. We just have stricter moral standards." The phrase rule of law was thrown around a lot. We claimed it as a Western value. They insisted that it was no less, and earlier in history, a value of Islam. We then said, so often as to become boring, "And what about the Revolutionary Guards, the powerful paramilitary force that reported directly to Ayatollah Khomeini and honored no apparent rule of law?" "That is an exception," they said, "because it is national security, and because the supreme leader is supreme." The guards, as uncultured hoodlums, were clearly an embarrassment to all of them, the clerics included. All understood that Khomeini used the guards to keep secularizing influences in check, the 5 Larijani brothers being a visible example. The Iranians completely misjudged the relationship between the Americans and the French. In the formal sessions, on many issues, we and the French would go at it hammer and tongs, shouting at each other and insisting on small, Talmudic distinctions. The Iranians saw this as showing light between us, when it was actually just that all Frenchmen and many Americans, especially Jews, liked to argue. Most of the French delegation had done postdocs or been professors in the United States. The Iranian misapprehension became clear after an unofficial session on Iranian nuclear ambitions. Rusta lectured us on his party line. Iran had no nuclear weapons program, never did have. This was a provably false statement then and now. Why should the West be sabotaging Iran's legitimate development of peaceful nuclear power? We countered, why did you declare nuclear facilities only after they were discovered by the West? We were magnifying an inconsequential detail, he insisted. Iran was still within its legal 6-month declaration period when the facilities were discovered. When the Iranians retired to their quarters for afternoon prayer, insisted on by the mullahs, the French and Americans gathered in the lounge for early cocktails. That was when we all compared notes on sidebar discussions. On this day, Henri gleefully reported that, after the nuclear lecture, he had taken Rusta aside. So, how do you really feel about nuclear weapons? Now, speaking in confidence to a sympathetic Frenchman, not an American, Rusta said, well, of course we need nuclear weapons, because of the threat from Israel in the inevitable coming religious war between Israel and Islam. He added that the French should surely understand this, since Iran's need was no different from that of de Gaulle's Force de Frappe. An unexpected third talking point that we heard repeatedly was this. We could easily solve our differences with the US, but never with the UK. This was history that few Americans ever learned, but that was seared into the brain of every Iranian schoolchild. From the time of the Anglo-Persian War in 1856 and through the 19th century, Britain had extracted economic concessions from Persia. By the turn of the 20th century, it was in all but name an occupying power. In 1925, it created out of whole cloth the illegitimate Pahlavi dynasty that ruled until the 1979 Islamic Revolution. By comparison, the CIA's involvement in a coup strengthening Pahlavi rule in 1954 was a peccadillo. We, the Americans and French, listened politely. From my Cold War participation in US-USSR exchanges, I had learned that every such event, however fraught, was supposed to produce a communique, jointly agreed to. My American colleagues thought this was silly. We agreed with the Iranians on virtually nothing. The Iranians, however, thought it a great idea. Overnight, I wrote a draft affirming the right of free scientific inquiry and denying any right of a government or religious establishment to interfere. These rights, along with fairness, transparency of process, and openness of results, should apply to natural scientists, social scientists, policymakers, philosophers, humanists, ethicists, and religious thinkers, I wrote. I wasn't exactly trying to poke a stick into Islamic eyes, but I did want to smoke out what were the limits that their government would allow them to agree to. The next day, the Iranians, including the mullahs, happily endorsed my draft as written. The only arguments came from the French. It only then dawned on me that the overriding goal of the Iranians was favorable publicity in the West, selling the vision of an Iran existing within international norms. In service of this goal, it didn't matter what they signed. This wasn't like negotiating with Cold War Soviets who would be debriefed by the KGB. No one was going to hold these Iranians accountable for anything they signed. At the closing banquet, Henri Korn, representing the French, said, "This has been a remarkable and friendly exchange, but we should not deceive ourselves that we have made any progress on the big issues." I concluded my remarks with, "We Americans have truly learned a lot this week about a country that has always seemed quite opaque to most of us. I mean France, of course." Chapter 64. Transitions. I've gotten ahead of myself and need to return to mid-2004 after I resigned, or Pete Nanos fired me, as Los Alamos deputy lab director. I had a safe home in Sally Keller's statistical science group and 3 years' salary support. But, for the year that Pete was still lab director, my goal of flying invisibly below the radar turned out to be impossible. The circulating, only slightly garbled version of the story was that I had stood up to Pete and been fired for it. I was a symbol of the resistance. Strangers came up to me in the supermarket to offer moral support. Thankfully, after Bob Kukuk became the calm lab director in 2005, I was able to sink into a desired obscurity. Outside committee work and amateur science diplomacy about half filled my calendar. I traveled from Los Alamos for meetings of the IDA board and executive committee and for the program advisory committees at its NSA-sponsored centers, for the Packard Fellows Selection Committee, for S&T Advisory Committees of NRO and DTRA, and for several NAS committees, including the nominating committee that chose climate scientist Ralph Cicerone to be the new NAS president, succeeding Bruce Alberts. I was again active in JSON and rejoined its steering committee. Texas billionaire Peter O'Donnell, a friend of my father's, kept me in his orbit by putting me on the visiting committee of the well-endowed by him Institute for Computational Science and Engineering, ICS, at UT Austin. These part-time activities were hardly the new career that I needed to invent. For that, I spent a year absorbing the culture of my new colleagues in statistics, going to their seminars, lunches, and knocking on office doors with questions. I started writing short mathematical notes on statistics questions that interested me. These notes weren't publishable. They were either too quirky or, the opposite, not original enough. But I thought them professional enough to post on my public webpage. I thought of them as markers that I was doing something about a career, not just serving on committees. Interesting to me was the contrast between statistics as used by smart astronomers, including, previously, me, and statistics as the discipline of the LANL Group's PhD card-carrying professionals. I thought the astronomers more creative. They had unique data sets that could be the product of years of observation at a cost of, especially for space observations, millions of dollars. If a new bespoke statistical technique could squeeze more out of a data set, then inventing and testing that technique was a small part of the overall effort. The published paper in an astronomy journal would report the astronomical observations and the scientific conclusions, and then also, often in an appendix, the derivation and validation of any new statistical methods used. Such methods might or might not ever be used again by anyone. That didn't matter. PhD statisticians, by contrast, functioned most often as consultants. Knowledgeable about a whole set of standard statistical methods, a graduate education's worth at least, the statistician parachuted into an ongoing project, learned just enough about it to select appropriate methods, applied them, or taught others to do so, and then went on to the next parachute drop. The process by which a really new method could become standard, taught in graduate schools, for example, was a long one. Proposed by someone in a paper in a theoretical statistics journal, a new idea might gradually gain acceptance as later papers by different authors proved broader and tighter theorems. Jackknife methods, so-called, were proposed by John Tukey in the 1950s and extended to bootstrap methods, so-called, by Brad Ephron in the 1970s. But it was not until the 2000s that these were fully accepted in the statistics canon. If astronomers were sometimes more creative, statisticians were slower and more rigorous. I learned a lot from my statistician coworkers, but at heart, I was in this respect always an astronomer. But it had been 8 years since I actually put pencil to paper or fingers to keyboard for an astrophysics calculation. The field had moved on without me. My historical knowledge was there, but my current knowledge was at about the level of a second-year, pre-thesis, graduate student. At age 56, I needed, at least in spirit, to go back to graduate school. For me, that meant Princeton, where John Bacall at IAS presided over a superb rotating group of postdocs and visitors. Across town at the university, my former student David Spergel now led a large group of graduate students and postdocs. David had recently succeeded Scott Tremaine as department chair. I couldn't move to Princeton full-time, but I started visiting IAS for a week every month or two and immersing myself again in astrophysics. "You need to talk to Arnie Levine and meet his postdocs," Bacall said to me suddenly on one of my trips, more an order than a suggestion. Levine was a famous biologist and ex-president of Rockefeller University. He inhabited that elite stratum of scientists who could reasonably wonder every October whether this was the year they would win a Nobel, in Arnie's case, for the discovery of the gene P53, whose mutation was one of the most frequent causes of human cancer. Arnie had been appointed as an IAS professor in 2004. His new group at IAS was the Institute's third attempt at a foray into life sciences. The previous two attempts had failed. That merits some backstory. The Institute for Advanced Studies director and board had neither the inclination nor the facilities to expand into experimental laboratory biology. Therefore, any biology program at IAS would have to be purely theoretical. But theory was a dirty word to biologists, this going all the way back to Darwin's exhortations that living things could be studied only by meticulous observation and controlled experiment. Biologists often specifically cited Darwin in distancing themselves from the hubris of theoretical physicists, who thought that there could be a single equation for a unified theory to explain everything. Indeed, IAS was heavily invested in such physicists, notably in Ed Witten's string theory group. The isolated subfield population genetics was an exception to biology's contempt for theory, perhaps because it had been founded in the 1930s mostly by statisticians rather than biologists. Ronald Fisher, the greatest statistician of the time, or perhaps ever, was a major figure. In the early 1980s, then-Princeton professor Bob May, the Australian-born mathematical biologist who later became Baron May of Oxford, supported a group of postdocs in population genetics at IAS. That effort folded when he decamped in 1988 back to the UK. May's protege Martin Nowak moved to IAS and refounded a population genetics group in 1998, but he too left, with all his group, for Harvard in 2003, in part because, as I heard it, the mathematicians at IAS didn't consider him rigorous enough and blocked his appointment as a permanent professor. Levine's appointment at IAS was an attempt not to repeat past mistakes. No one could question Arnie's credentials in biology, and he was not a population geneticist. He made no overt claim to being mathematical, but he was a math groupie who loved talking to math and string theory faculty at the daily IAS afternoon teas. In truth, Arnie loved talking to everybody. His vision for biology at IAS was that he would hire smart physics PhDs as postdocs and train them in all forms of biology that could be done without a lab, and without ever calling them theory: computational biology, systems biology, bioinformatics, comparative genomics, and so forth. Arnie maintained a real lab at Rutgers. His dry people at IAS met weekly with his wet people at Rutgers, and they often collaborated on separate parts of the same effort. Arnie introduced me to his postdoc, Harlan Robbins. Harlan, with a PhD in string theory, had gone to the Weizmann Institute in Israel as a particle physicist and emerged 2 years later as an incipient biologist. 2 years in Arnie's group were completing his transition. Recent converts are always the most observant, and Harlan was an enthusiastic proselytizer. He was also a fan of numerical recipes. Why was I wasting time trying to reclaim my lost reputation in astrophysics? He sermonized. Computational biology was a wide-open field. He would get me started. We could collaborate. Harlan became my tutor when I visited, and remotely by email. He told me to work my way through Bruce Albert's massive Molecular Biology of the Cell, and it became my bedtime reading for almost a year. And, as backup, we both had Arnie, another enthusiastic proselytizer, for consultations. Harlan's pitch resonated. Going to both the astronomy and the biology seminars at IAS, I noticed that I was more current and asked better questions at the latter. There were two effects. At Lanell, I had been midwife to and paid for Jill Truella's new B Biosciences division. As Jill brought in new PhDs and some more senior people as possible hires, I usually went to their talks, and I was usually their last appointment of the day to sell them on the lab. It now seemed that some of my immersion in bio had stuck. At least superficially, I knew more about what was exciting in biology than I did about astrophysics. The second effect was a more general phenomenon. As a computer person, if you move to a new field, you automatically bring with you a dowry. There are algorithms and programs standard in your old field that your new field hasn't assimilated or doesn't even know about. With a small amount of guidance, there is low-hanging fruit to be found. I didn't, at this time, know the history of IAS's previous missteps in biology. I once went running into Arnie's office with a book on population genetics that I had found in the IAS library, undoubtedly acquired there during the May or Nowak eras. "Finally," I crowed, "a biology book that speaks to me. Look, differential equations, diffusion processes, probability distributions." Arnie took the book and looked at it. "Yeah, population genetics. They made us take a course in it in graduate school. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking that it is real biology." I took this to heart as an early lesson. Arnie pushed me toward core biology, as opposed to things that might inform life sciences, but were dominated by techniques from other disciplines: biophysics, biochemistry, applied mathematics, and so on. I learned also from Arnie that there was a biological intuition that the best biologists all had. I already knew what physical intuition meant for physicists. Physical intuition meant knowing how a calculation was going to come out before you did it. It was an ability somehow to visualize the behavior of physical systems, even unfamiliar ones. Feynman was famous for this. My good physical intuition was a main strength of my career. Biologists too had intuition, but it was different. Several times, I went to Arnie with a computational genomics idea and told him that I was thinking of spending a couple of weeks or more writing computer code to investigate it. "You're wasting your time," he said. "You won't find what you are looking for." "Well, how do you know that?" I asked. "Life just doesn't work that way." He was generally right. Harlan's and my first paper together, published in PNAS, was about microRNAs, small fragments of RNA that are encoded in a certain special way in the human genome and that become functional in post-transcriptional gene regulation. These had only recently been discovered, and it was a hot topic. We used existing published data and databases to show that certain types of genes tended to be in microRNAs, regulatory pathways, other types of genes not. It was a small contribution, but it was biology, so for me it was a big deal. Harlan and I wrote one other paper together. On my own, I then got interested in some mathematical aspects of medical MRI imaging, and back in Los Alamos, worked on that for a few months, yielding another publication in PNAS. On this thin record of publications, I began to think of myself as a biologist. My biologist friends, in Jason, for example, thought this laughable, but they were a tolerant bunch. David Hausler was an especially useful tutor during summer Jason sessions, as was his later replacement in Jason, Sean Eddy. John Bockel's order sending me to Arnie Levine was not, I think, a random event. John then knew, but hid from his friends and colleagues, that he was suffering from a rare, fatal blood cancer. He encouraged my work with Harlan and kept up to date on it, hearing about it from Harlan when I was not at IAS. In my last email from John, he looks forward to my next visit at the end of August 2005. He died on August 17th of that year, age 70. He had been my professional mentor and my friend for more than 30 years. In 2009, the astronauts on the Hubble Space Telescope repair mission carried John and Neda's wedding rings into orbit and back. The Hubble repair mission was a success. Towards the end of 2005, I had a phone call from Marianne Rankin, the Dean of Natural Sciences at UT Austin. We had never met. I was recommended to her by Roy Schwitters because he knew that at LANL, I had become, at least organizationally, a statistician. Marianne knew also that I was in Peter O'Donnell's orbit and on the visiting committee of his ICS Institute in a university unit that was not under her direct control. The reason for her call was convoluted. In decades past, there had been a functioning statistics department at UT, but in the 1970s and 80s, statistics as a separate academic field went into eclipse. A lot of places, including Texas, merged their statistics departments with their math departments. Then, in the 2000s, statistics, especially computational statistics with its connections to computer science and artificial intelligence, was once again a hot field. Rankin wanted to reestablish a statistics department at UT. She envisioned an outward-looking department that could be home not only to PhD statisticians, but via joint appointments to people in application areas. "You're an astronomer doing biology in a statistics department," she said happily. She was exaggerating my accomplishments, but not my ideals. "I want to move you to UT," she said. I was amenable to being courted. Even though Nanos was no longer LANL director, it was time for me to move on. It was a good bet that Harvard wouldn't take me back, and in any case, Jeffrey and I had promised each other that we would never move back to Northeastern winters. Austin, which was just beginning to become a high-tech hub, seemed like a great place to be. It was an odd recruitment. Academic hirings are normally done by departments, but here, I was dealing directly with the dean. And Marianne was not a typical dean of that time, or now. At our first meeting, instead of lunch at the nearby faculty club, she led me half a mile to a crowded hamburger place full of undergraduates. For my second trip, she put Jeffrey and me up at the Four Seasons Hotel in a suite. Our flight was delayed. When we finally got to the hotel near midnight, she was waiting in the lobby to welcome us, had been waiting for several hours. Later, after we were established in Austin, I once mentioned to Marianne that Jeffrey and I were going to a fancy dress ball and that Jeffrey had not yet found something to wear. That afternoon, an assistant from the dean's office appeared at my office with an armload of expensive gowns from Marianne's closet. The two of them were the same size. Jeffrey should borrow whatever gowns she wanted and return them when she was done, her assistant told me. But if Marianne Rankin was not the typical dean, neither was I the typical candidate for a professorship. My former job at Los Alamos was equivalent to an academic provost or vice president. I sent Marianne a spreadsheet calculating the relative value of UT's and Lionel's benefits and what it would take in salary to give me a modest 5% increase over Los Alamos in total compensation. I don't think she actually looked at it. She instead went to Peter O'Donnell, who provided $2 million to endow a chair, plus $1 million for my startup and research costs, but only on condition that I made my home in his ICES Institute, where he would also pay for remodeling an office suite to my specifications. Towards the end of these negotiations, Marianne phoned to say that I should probably pay a visit to the physics department since they would be voting on my tenure. I couldn't occupy a position in a new statistics department because it didn't exist yet. Since she was supplying physics with a new faculty line, the vote was a formality. "But I don't want to be in physics," I said. "I want a joint appointment in biology and computer science." "Oh," she managed to say. "Then I'll see what I can do." It took a week. Integrative Biology, IB, which happened to be her home department, was willing to vote tenure on her say-so, despite my having only two published papers in life sciences. Computer science insisted that I actually come and give a job talk. I did, and they then voted me in. I liked the Texan way of doing things, open to wild, crazy ideas, and able to brush aside bureaucratic obstacles. If I had been still at Harvard and proposed to my biologist friends, many of whom I knew in social settings, that they vote me tenure just because I wanted to be biologist, they would have thought it a joke, and not a funny one. The biologists at Texas were welcoming. I knew Edward Marcotte from when he was a Packard Fellow, and his lab was particularly interesting to me. Soon after I arrived, I developed collaborations with his and several other labs and attended their weekly lab meetings. In departmental matters, though, I gravitated to the computer science department. Neither fish nor fowl, I was slightly more computer scientist than biologist. Notwithstanding, the biologists were a lot more fun to socialize with. The integrative biology department at UT had an interesting history. There had been a single biology department from time immemorial until the 1970s. Then, as at many places, that department fissioned into a forward-looking Department of Cellular and Molecular Biology, CMB, and a traditional Department of Integrative Biology, IB. The latter a dumping ground, really, for the botanists and zoologists who couldn't or wouldn't embrace the new molecular revolution, DNA, Watson and Crick, and so forth. But over some years, IB began making unconventional appointments in fields like ecology, evolution theory, molecular systematics, bioinformatics, and the more mathematical subfields of biology generally, yes, including population genetics. Unexpectedly, the botanists and zoologists proved willing to vote professorships for people quite different from themselves. By the time I arrived in Texas, IB was ranked one of the top departments in the country, its ecology and evolution graduate program well into the top 10. CMB's national rank had stabilized in the 30s. My other department, computer science, was generally ranked nationally around 12, but top 10 in certain sub-areas. Ironically, the original reason I was recruited to help nucleate a new statistics department gradually evaporated. There did come to exist a statistics department in which I was an affiliated faculty member. But that department evolved not into the kind of broad-based, outward-looking department that Marianne had envisioned, but, despite my being there and involved in the discussions, into a respectable, scholarly department in theoretical statistics that hired almost exclusively people with statistics PhDs, people who published in statistics journals. I was, for a time, listed on the department's website, but it was a polite fiction. Jeffrey and I decided to keep our house in Los Alamos for vacations and summers, recreating our Massachusetts arrangement of each owning one house solely. I sold my share of our Los Alamos house to her, with the plan that I would own our Texas house when we got one. The transaction necessitated formally transferring the jointly held title into Jeffrey's name at the title company. Small town life. Within hours, word spread that we were getting divorced. That was the only reason that joint property was ever transferred to the wife's name. People came up to Jeffrey in the supermarket to express their sympathy. Roy Schwitters arranged for Jeffrey and me to be elected to Austin's Tuesday Club, which met monthly for dinner and a semi-intellectual talk. The club had been founded by Steve and Louise Weinberg when they moved to Texas, and it had about 200 members. By charter, half were from the university, half from Austin public life, lawyers, business people, politicians, etc., almost all wealthy. Jeffrey learned a lesson in Texas deadpan humor, or Texans' disdain for nosy Yankees, when she grilled a succession of non-university members about their fortunes. Oil and gas, ma'am, some said, which could mean anything from that they once worked at a gas station to that they were retired ExxonMobil executives. The other standard answer was, land and cattle, ma'am, which often meant careers in the Dallas corporate world, and a small family ranch for the weekends. It was also at Tuesday Club, sometime later, that Jeffrey and I found ourselves at a table with, by chance, no other university people, discussing U.S. income inequality and the socially indefensible wealth fraction of the 1%. While wealthy, these were all progressive Austinites, almost a prerequisite for being invited to join Tuesday Club. I volunteered that, while Jeffrey and I usually made it into the 1%, the threshold had risen with stock market gains that particular year, and we had dropped off. We were in the 2%. The table fell silent. I could see them all thinking, "You poor bastard." Soon after, I began to have a recurring dream. I am in a tumbrel crowded with wealthy 1%ers being carted to the guillotine. With both hands, I hoist myself over the edge, just enough to see the jeering proletarian crowds throwing rocks at us. "Let me out," I shout. "It's all a mistake. I'm only in the 2%. Chapter 65. PCAST. Before his January 2009 inauguration, new President Barack Obama had already named John Holdren as his full-time science advisor and announced that his President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology would be co-chaired by a triumvirate of Holdren, Harold Varmus, and Eric Lander. I noted the fact that, while I knew all three slightly or by reputation, I knew none well. Maybe I wasn't as important as I thought I was. Or maybe Obama wasn't appointing to PCAST the right people. That was to say, my best friends. I was surprised then to get in March a phone call from Lander, and even more surprised to be asked to join PCAST. There would be 20 members. We would meet in Washington for 2 days every 2 months and hopefully meet with the president on each occasion. We would deal with big issues: climate, environment, healthcare, energy, national security, federal science funding, international technological competitiveness, whatever else we came up with. I accepted on the spot. It turned out that all 20 of us accepted on the spot, unprecedented in the any of the co-chairs' previous experience. Obama had campaigned on a message of hope, and we all now wanted to be part of it. Not just the co-chairs, but this whole PCAST seemed drawn from circles entirely disjoint from mine. This was no casual observation. I had actual data. Before the inauguration, NAS President Ralph Cicerone had solicited from NAS members their suggestions for PCAST membership. I sent in a list of 40 names. My list had zero matches to the 20 eventually chosen. Of the 20 new PCAST members, I knew only one well, Ernie Moniz, as MIT Physics Department Chair in the early 1990s, and then, both of us in new roles, when he was Undersecretary of Energy during my first 2 years at Los Alamos. Ernie had a raging case of Potomac fever. The surprise now was only that didn't get a higher position in the administration, an error corrected 4 years later when he became Secretary of Energy, succeeding Steve Chu. Five more members I knew, just barely. Chris Chiba was an astrophysicist before he transitioned into public policy at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Shirley Ann Jackson, a physicist, had been chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission under Bill Clinton, afterwards becoming president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Her multi-million-dollar annual compensation made headlines, the stories dutifully noting her path-breaking role as an African-American woman. Shirley was on John Brown's Director's Advisory Committee at Los Alamos, where her contributions were sensible, imperious, and never outside the box. Barbara Schall was a biologist at Washington University in St. Louis, a protege of Peter Raven. Peter and I both participated on the nominating committee that chose her as NAS vice president, but I didn't otherwise know her. Ahmed Zawail was Caltech's famous Nobelist in laser chemistry. I had met him just a couple of times. Maxine Savitz, a retired engineer from Honeywell, was vice president of the National Academy of Engineering, NAE, and we had briefly overlapped on the NAS NAE 30-member report review committee. I didn't feel badly for not knowing the three PCAST members who were billionaires. Eric Schmidt was the CEO of Google, then running that giant enterprise on behalf of its laid-back founders, Page and Brin. Craig Mundy had founded a computer company that was absorbed by Microsoft in the 1980s. Mundy acquired early stock options and became Microsoft's head of research and long-term strategy. David Shaw was a computer scientist who in the 1980s founded D.E. Shaw & Co., one of the two most successful quant hedge fund companies in the world. In recent years, Shaw had withdrawn from active participation in his company and now headed an Institute of Computational Biology at Columbia, built and funded by him personally. I also knew only by reputation Rick Levin, the long-serving Yale president, Mario Molina, the Nobelist atmospheric chemist, and Chad Merkin, a famously entrepreneurial and self-promoting materials chemist at Northwestern. There were four members I had never even heard of: environmental scientist Rosina Bierbaum, physician Christine Castle, biotechnology entrepreneur Ed Penhote, and Maryland theoretical physicist Sylvester Jim Gates. I smile as I write this because, over the next 8 years, Chris Castle and Jim Gates would become lifetime personal friends, even beyond the close professional bonds that I would develop with most of the others, Lander, Schall, Mundy, Levin, and Savitz especially. How I came to be included on the PCAST roster was something that I eventually found out. Geography helped. I could be branded as a Texan, yet secretly be thought of as a Harvard professor. Interdisciplinarity helped. I could be touted as someone with experience in both physical and life sciences. Jason and Los Alamos helped. Apart from longtime expert Holdren, Chris Chiba and I were the only PCAST members with any experience at all in national security issues, and his was mostly in arms control and non-proliferation. I was the house nuclear warrior. Lander later described to me the afternoon in his Broad Institute office when he, Holdren, and Varmus wrote names on his whiteboard and moved them in different colors from column to column according to their attributes, ending up with the PCAST list. There had been a PCAST under President George W. Bush, chaired by his science advisor Jack Marburger and co-chaired by Floyd Kavama, a right-wing venture capitalist. Its roster included just one working scientist. 8 years earlier, in fall 2001, I had happened to be at a meeting at Stony Brook with Jack, who was then the director of Brookhaven National Laboratory. He was called out of the room and returned, somewhat pale, to say that he had just been asked, with no warning, to become Bush's science advisor. Over the next 8 years, his loyal, outspoken defense of the Bush administration's anti-science policies cost him his reputation in the scientific community. Once, sitting next to him at a private IDA trustees dinner, I tortured him by trying to get him to admit that it was in fact a tough time for science in the White House, to get him to break character in private and off the record. He wouldn't do it. He was loyal to the end. He died 2 years after leaving office. Obama's PCAST list had, depending on how you counted us, about 10 working scientists. The membership was announced by President Obama in a speech at the NAS annual meeting in April. We 20 were seated in two reserved front rows before the president arrived. You could overhear the speculation in the packed NAS auditorium. We were mostly recognizable as NAS members, but why the reserved seats? Smarter NAS members figured it out before Obama got to that part of his talk. Immediately after the speech, we had our picture taken with the president in the NAS boardroom, under the oil painting of President Lincoln handing the Academy's founders the Academy Charter. Soon after I got back to Austin, I had a communication from a functionary in the university president's office informing me that Texas law forbade dual positions of honor, trust, or profit in state or federal government. My professorship was one position. PCAST, even though unpaid, was an illegal second. Luckily, there was a waiver procedure. The regents of the University of Texas in due course voted, by a docket action with hundreds of such items, to make an honest man of me. A few months after that, the White House sent me my commission, a parchment document like a diploma, written in archaic language, the blanks filled in a calligraphic hand. The President of the United States reposed special trust in the integrity and ability, filled in, of William Henry Press of Texas, ditto, and appointed him to PCAST, of course spelled out, during the pleasure of the President of the United States for the time being, ditto. Military commissions, I learned later, filled in the first blank with valor and fidelity rather than integrity and ability. My friends who had been in and out of government deflated me by mentioning their whole collections of commissions because they got a new one every time their exact title or the administration changed. Still, it was a thrill for me. Meanwhile, PCAST had started meeting, first in what was grandly called the White House Conference Center, but was actually a maze of small rooms in the connected 19th-century townhouses fronting on Lafayette Square, and soon after, in the more imposing and comfortable facilities of the NAS. For the prestige of hosting PCAST, the Academy had even waived its usual gold-plated room charges. Every two-day PCAST meeting had to have, by law, a public session. These usually featured speakers of cabinet, sub-cabinet, or agency head level. They were people promoting something, a program, piece of legislation, or their own careers, and happy to have a public forum with White House branding. Larry Summers, National Economic Council, Carol Browner, White House Climate Office, John Brennan, Counterterrorism Czar, Rod Shaw, USAID, Ash Carter, by then Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Still Rising, and Regina Dugan, DARPA, were examples. Summers' joy at being rehabilitated into government was radiant. He had been in the private sector wilderness, at D.E. Shaw and Company, actually, after being forced out as president of Harvard. He must have spent those 3 years wondering whether his unperson status would be permanent. Dugan was someone I knew well from a decade earlier, when she had been a DARPA program director and an enthusiastic Jason sponsor. We Jason stayed in touch with her while she was out of government. As a new DARPA director, she was the keynote speaker at the Jason 50th anniversary dinner that was held at the Army-Navy Club. A kind of trademark, Regina always wore flashy shoes of high fashion or high grunge, always in bright colors. "Regina, I love your shoes," was the way I always greeted her. We had once discussed our shared opinion that women in senior positions should present themselves not as male clones, but any different way they chose to. The PCAST co-chairs divided us into five working groups, each of which was supposed to meet several times, extra meetings in Washington as necessary, consult non-PCAST experts, and come up with one or more studies that could produce reports and recommendations for the president. Chris Chaiba and I were designated co-leads of the National Security Working Group. There was no one else with the background or willingness to join our group, so Holdren and Lander assigned themselves to it for form's sake. They never actually met with us. The other working groups were healthcare reform, climate and carbon management, advanced manufacturing, and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, education. I thought that there were plenty of good national security topics for a group like PCAST to study and weigh in on. The need for new technologies and infrastructures for cyber defense, a nuclear weapons refurbishment strategy, horrendously expensive, that was based on selling questionable science to generals, an intelligence community that was missing the strategic utility of unmanned air vehicles, drones, and ceding their operation to the military for tactical use only. A look at deterrence by science, the idea that adversaries took notice of the significant scientific talent at the weapons labs and would notice if it were allowed to decay. The inchoate mass of second-rate research that embodied the portfolio of the Department of Homeland Security. Chiba didn't particularly like any of my topics. His own were things like options for space arms control, technology for non-proliferation monitoring in Iran, and the like. He was an arms controller first and foremost. Over most of a year, Chiba and I elaborated our list of topics and made use of PCAST's notable convening power. PCAST had a PhD-level staff of four, initially led by Debbie Stein, and later by Marjorie Blumenthal, whom I had long known through NENAS and CSTB. The PCAST staff were not shy about cold-calling people with, "Hello, I'm calling from the White House." Chiba and I could easily summon deputy undersecretaries and assistant secretaries of defense to meet with us. In turn, Chiba and I presented our suggestions to PCAST in the group's private sessions, each topic fleshed out with a few paragraphs of text. To most PCAST members, we might as well have been speaking in tongues. Mixing the metaphor, national security was, to them, insider baseball. Craig Mundy expressed interest in topics with a cyber dimension, but he was the exception. With a mostly mute membership, it fell to John Holdren to pass judgment on whether we should proceed to organize a full-scale study. That judgment was always no. "I'll consult with the NSC on that," he would say, diplomatically. Or, "Let's let the interagency process operate." Or, "This is too sensitive right now." Or my favorite, "Let's for now adopt a watchful stance." Chiba's topics did hardly any better than mine. Eventually, I got the message. Our working group's existence notwithstanding, Holdren's view of PCAST was that it should stay away from national security, other than in the very broad sense of economic security, advanced manufacturing, environmental security, climate, and the like. Apologizing to Chiba, I abandoned him and formally switched my membership to the Healthcare Reform Task Force, led by Christine Castle. Chiba renamed his working group as International Security, but I don't recall it actually giving birth to any significant report. An important national concern at this time was the glacial pace at which electronic health records, EHRs, were being adopted by U.S. hospitals and medical practices. At the beginning of the Obama administration, fewer than 20% of clinical organizations had electronic record-keeping for anything other than billing. Paper and rooms with shelves full of files, these often misfiled, were the norm. Following the 2008 financial crisis, Congress enacted the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, an $800 billion economic stimulus package. Rushed into law, RRA agglomerated the wish lists of even low-level administration staffers. Happily, S&T figured in many of those lists. Pasted into the 1,000-page ARRA, its whole never completely understood by any legislator who voted for it, was the High-Tech Act, or if you insist, the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act. This appropriated $2 billion to establish a new agency, the obtusely named Office of the National Coordinator. ONC was empowered to set technical standards for EHRs and the electronic exchange of medical data among clinicians. Then, elsewhere in high-tech, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the agency responsible for servicing Medicare payments, was authorized to dole out $20 billion to physicians who made meaningful use of ONC's standards. The problem was that these two agencies, ONC and CMS, could or would barely talk to each other, much less work together. Harvard Medical School's David Blumenthal, as the first director of ONC, recruited experts from the medical informatics and computer science communities and organized nimble standards groups populated by first-rate people. CMS, by contrast, was a behemoth. Its job was to disperse $500 billion a year to doctors and hospitals. Its batch computer mainframes, with architectures dating back to the 1970s, could barely keep up. CMS viewed as its customers the medical practitioners who wanted faster, never challenged payments, not the American public who wanted better health care. Implementing high-tech, the agency moved toward enacting a ridiculously low bar for meaningful use, in essence giving away $20 billion to clinicians for doing almost nothing. PCAST, especially Castle, directly engaged. Some people, including unfortunately Eric Lander, misinterpreted Chris's always calm speaking tone, the physician's reassuring bedside manner, as ambivalence, or saw her as a lightweight. I soon thought otherwise. Chris always had in mind a specific outcome, and she usually achieved it. Eric, in private, spoke of Castle as our pediatrician. Her specialty was actually gerontology, and she was at the time president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. In later years, she was the founding dean of the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine in Pasadena, California. In December 2010, PCAST published a major report that endorsed ONC's approach and held CMS's feet to the fire to make meaningful use actually meaningful. More important than just the report was shopping it around to congressional staffers, officials in the Department of Health and Human Services, professional societies, and more. I contributed to this effort in two ways. First, Craig Mundy and I worked together to specify the technical details of our proposed information infrastructure, the descriptions and recommendations for action. Second, it somehow fell to me to write much of the report and to organize and edit the rest. It was a surprise to me then, and afterwards, that top levels of the U.S. power structure were filled with people who couldn't write well or wouldn't write at all. Well, didn't have to mean brilliantly or grippingly or luminously or poetically, just serviceably. I suppose this proves that writing ability has little to do with success. But some people have to be able to write, and I remained grateful to Kip, who, as my PhD advisor, drove me to become one of those people. With the eventual universal use of EHRs would come the possibility of doing better comparative effectiveness research. This is a term of art for trying to observe statistically which drugs on the market were actually better than their competitors. HITECH appropriated money for this, but the big pharma companies proved able to neuter any such effort. Big pharma made money from copycat drugs that were no better, and probably often worse, than the first to market. In a long-standing example of regulatory capture by an industry, FDA, in drug approvals, never asked for proof of comparative effectiveness, but only of effectiveness. Outside of PCAST, I got interested in the mathematics of how one might, in theory, slowly meter an effective but perhaps inferior drug into the market while accumulating comparative statistics. I found an objective scheme by which only the best drugs for a condition would gradually escape restrictions on use, poorer drugs eliminated. This would be, in effect, a radical new way of doing phase 3 clinical trials much more efficiently, both in terms of cost and patient welfare. My paper on this was published in PNAS along with a commentary piece by Chris Castle explaining it. But the idea never went anywhere. My UT colleague Peter Miller, whose own work was in medical statistics, told me that while my scheme was sound, it was far, far too radical. Miller and colleagues were butting heads with FDA regulators just to get approval for the use in clinical trials of elementary Bayesian approaches, methods in use for 50 years in other fields. By the end of the Obama administration, EHR use had jumped from 20% to 80%. PCAST helped, I like to think, along with the in-government efforts of Blumenthal, his successors Chuck Friedman and Farzad Mostashari, Anish Chopra, and Todd Park. Anish was appointed by Obama as the first Chief Technology Officer of the United States, a corny title, I thought. He functioned in practice as John Holdren's technology deputy. Todd Park succeeded Anish when the latter left to run for Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. I got along well with Anish and knew some months in advance that he was going to take this leap into elective politics. I wondered, didn't he need a whole political machine behind him for fundraising and the like? He told me that, as an Indian American, he had one automatically. A network of rich Indian Americans stood ready to support any reasonable candidate of their ilk. I was surprised for at most 2 seconds. Didn't Jews support Jews? Didn't Italian Americans support Italian Americans? Ethnic politics is a deeply American fact of life. However, Anish failed to win his Democratic primary. In PCAST, my ability to write and also organize the contents of reports got me the reputation of a kind of script doctor. Several groups called on me to work on their draft reports. A notable example was a PCAST report on radio spectrum allocation led by Mark Gornberg. As subsequently adopted by the FCC, that report's recommendations affected over the next decade something like $1 trillion of commerce, by far PCAST's most economically significant intervention. In my adopted PCAST niche, most of my colleagues liked me well enough. I was useful, if often irreverent, and occasionally outside the box. John Holdren was a puzzle, however. John was always friendly to me, but in sessions that he chaired, where we were supposed to be called on in the order that we raised our tent cards, he seemed often to call on me last or not at all, then noting that time was short. This was a petty grievance, but it was statistically significant. I used to keep track and update the significance calculation during meetings. Working with Eric was never easy, but there was a streak of genius in him that made me tolerant of his bullying. It was often, "Bring me a rock," followed, after much work by me or others, by, "No, not that rock. Bring me a different rock." He was a perfectionist and wanted things done his way. Co-chair Harold Varmus wrote fluently and brilliantly. Shirley Tilghman, as president of Princeton, once described Harold as the Shakespeare of committee reports. In mid-2010, Varmus resigned from PCAS to direct the National Cancer Institute. His was an act of patriotism. NCI director was a step down from NIH director, which he had been in the 1990s. That left Holdren and Lander as co-chairs, in practice just Eric, since John already had too much to do. After 6 months, the two decided to reorganize PCAST by elevating two members to the awkward title co-vice chair. Maxine Savitz, who was vice president of NAE, was one of these. Symmetrically, the other ought to have been Barbara Schall, then vice president of the NAS. But instead, it was me. I was surprised and accepted. For the next 6 years, John, Eric, Maxine, and I met by phone weekly for an hour and met in Washington for dinner at one or another expensive restaurant of John's choosing and dividing the check evenly the night before PCAST plenary meetings. John, a wine connoisseur, had expensive tastes, so I always tried to drink my share of the two or three bottles that he ordered for us. Because Maxine and I shared cabs to the same meetings so frequently, the doorman at the Palomar Hotel thought that we were married. If it was just one of us, he would ask about the health of the other. We never corrected him. When I checked in once with Jeffrey, he gave me an odd and then knowing look. Chapter 66. Obama, during Obama's two terms, PCAST met with the president more than 20 times, about 3 times a year. It was only half as many meetings as had been originally promised, but, we learned, such promises are malleable and routinely ignored by the all-powerful presidential schedulers, or else honored but then overtaken by events in real time. The schedulers blocked 45 minutes for each of our meetings, but Obama often waved off the staffers who came to get him at the end of the time and typically gave us an hour, sometimes more. For some reason, perhaps just day of the week, the next thing after us on the president's calendar was often his meeting with Vice President Biden. After being kept waiting a few times, Biden began wandering into our meetings, at first at the end of our scheduled 45 minutes, later from the start. Like all vice presidents, he didn't seem to have a lot to do. Once, when Obama did leave at the scheduled time, and we were all standing respectfully for the presidential exit, as was the custom, Biden piped up, "Hey guys, could you sit down again? I have a couple of things I want to ask you." We did, and his couple of things went for more than another hour. PCAST members were looking at their watches and deciding whether the Vice President of the United States was worth missing their flight home for. They would do so for Obama, of course. Had we known that Biden would one day be president, the choice would have been easier. Our initial meetings with Obama were quite formal and were held in the large state dining room. We had so-called green badges that got us through the White House gate. The PCCAST staff had blue badges, which let them escort us up the driveway and into the main White House front door. We arrived half an hour before the scheduled time and could circulate around the marbled entrance and cross halls, so-called, and the other ceremonial rooms, the red, the blue, and the green. The single uniformed guard didn't seem to be bothered by our sitting on the sofas and chairs or touching things, not like the public tours. The White House was really just a house, grander and more significant than most, but in no way a palace like, say, Versailles or Buckingham or Schönbrunn. A dimly lit staircase up to the family quarters was next to the front door, seemingly, but probably not actually, unguarded. It was fun to see the originals of familiar presidential portraits, especially taking note of their positioning. Republican presidents were off in the corners. Nixon was nowhere. George W. Bush not yet painted. Prominent, and to me moving, was the famous Schickler portrait of JFK, arms folded, eyes downcast, face in shadow. Lincoln and LBJ got especially good locations. In the state dining room, we were seated around the long table, assigned places with name tent cards, before the president arrived. Each place had a thin pad of White House notepaper and a cheap White House pen, souvenirs that most of us kept after the meeting. A separate long row of chairs, behind us and facing the president, was for OSTP and White House staff. These first meetings with the president attracted only second or third tier White House staff. We were just another big group of outsiders on the presidential calendar. That seemed to be how Obama initially also saw us. He entered. We stood. He went around the table and shook hands with each individual, flashing the charismatic campaign grin. He sat. We sat. John Holdren's meeting memorandum in front of him included biographical notes on some members, not including me, so that Obama could make polite chit-chat about Dr. Molina's Nobel Prize or Dr. Jackson's latest honorary degree. He addressed us all as doctor, even the industrialists who weren't. Co-chairs Holdren, Lander, and Varmus did most of the talking at the first meeting. Before the full PCAST's first meeting, an ad hoc group of a few outside experts, all close colleagues of the co-chairs, had produced a now PCAST-branded report on the 2009 H1N1 swine flu epidemic, what U.S. strategy should be for managing it. Obama listened to their presentation with interest, but by this time, vaccination was widespread and cases were declining. A decade later, when the COVID-19 pandemic shut down the world economy and killed a million Americans, H1N1 would be looked back on ruefully as a missed opportunity to have made improvements in the U.S. public health system, including many that were recommended by PCAST and other groups. Our second meeting with the president was a few months later, also in the state dining room, and as formal as the first. By then, our several working groups had produced fleshed-out proposals for full reports. The plan was to summarize these to the president and to get his instructions on which should proceed. That clearly was not what he wanted or expected. He glared at us. When, for each topic, we arrived at, "Well, Mr. President, what do you think?" he responded with some variation of a statement that we were supposed to tell him what was interesting, not the other way around. One item that did get Obama's obvious interest was a prospectus by Jim Gates for a study on improving K-12 STEM education, especially for underrepresented minorities. Jim, with Shirley Jackson, was one of two African Americans in our group. Under most circumstances, Jim's manner was polite, even courtly, a perhaps unworldly theoretical physicist. This was the academic string theorist that he, in fact, was. His unruly dreadlocks seemed in line with the personal eccentricities of mathematicians generally. Now, when he was forcefully lecturing a black president about the need to create opportunities for black kids, his appearance seemed to be making a different point. He was an activist. "We must raise the average level of science education for African American children," he exhorted. Obama interrupted him. "Dr. Gates, I'm even more interested in ensuring opportunity for the very best kids, the talented ones capable of reaching the very top." Obama didn't say, "like you and me," but those words hung invisibly in the air. This was a first glimpse, we would see many more, of Barack Obama's contradictory nature. He was a populist, but also an elitist. He was a community activist, but also a University of Chicago professor of constitutional law. He campaigned like the former, but governed like the latter. He could flash the jubilant Obama grin, or rarely seen in public, but often by us, deliver the corrosive Obama stare. Obama was black by virtue of an African father, but he was raised in Hawaii by a white mother and white grandparents in Kansas. He attended the elite Punahou private school. He came to self-identify as African American only later at Columbia. We in PCAST seldom saw the populist or the African American Obama. Obama's dual nature has been much written about by journalists and historians. In the 2008 election, African American leaders wrestled with whether to fully embrace Obama as one of their own. They eventually did. They had to. If we believe in Occam's razor, explaining the most facts with the fewest hypotheses, then Bill Clinton was the first black president and Barack Obama was a Midwesterner. We saw a Chicago law professor, albeit later, one with a certain playfulness and a wry sense of humor. Jim Gates and I later talked about his presidential encounter. We shared the view that the history of America was the tragic history of its race relations. Race was America's central theme, monstrously enshrined in the very Constitution, and you couldn't understand America without facing the awful fact squarely. My white colleagues usually avoided talking about race with black acquaintances. I wasn't shy in this way and felt that there was a lot that I might and should learn. Jim was a military brat who had grown up in or near army bases around the country. He first experienced a segregated school in high school in Orlando, Florida. Talented in math, he applied and was admitted to MIT for college, after which, a successful academic career. He and I became friends and crossed paths many times later on. PCAST's third meeting with President Obama was a different kind of flop. We were in the more intimate old family dining room, but this still one of the ceremonial, not West Wing rooms. We had taken Obama's admonition to heart, and in our own private session earlier in the day, agreed on a list of important things happening in science, things that we thought the president should know about. 10 of us, not including me, were assigned topics on which to prepare snappy 3-minute talks. A minute into the first talk, Obama said, "Yeah, I read about that in the New York Times. What's your next topic?" And so it went. There were perhaps 3 of the 10 topics that he didn't already know about. We finished with 20 minutes still left. The president looked at his watch. At this point, Mario Molina chose to compound the disaster by going completely off script. "Mr. President," he said, "since we have some extra time, I'd like to talk to you about the urgency of taking action on climate change." He then launched into an earnest but insultingly elementary lecture on the subject. Obama's face hardened, but he waited for Molina to finish, which took a while. "Dr. Molina," he said sourly, "you don't have to convince me that human-caused climate change is real." He went on to give us a law professor lecture about the political realities. His administration had barely succeeded in getting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, enacted. The 2010 midterm election campaign was in full swing and looked to be tough for the Democrats. He didn't need PCAST weighing in with a report on climate that, however factually accurate, would be politically controversial. We could work around the edges of the climate issue on things like clean energy and environmental capital. "We should stay away from climate directly," he told us. History records that the 2010 elections were one of the most disastrous for an incumbent party in U.S. history. Democrats lost control of the House with a loss of 63 House seats and barely retained control of the Senate, losing 6 seats. Climate was now even more politically untouchable, especially with new fears for Obama's re-election chances. Before the midterms, Obama's 2010 State of the Union address, SOTU to insiders, called out the overwhelming scientific evidence of climate change. After the midterms, the 2011 SOTU didn't mention climate at all. John Holdren, who had become science advisor with climate at the top of his personal agenda, could not help but be disappointed. The president consoled Holdren that climate's day would come after the 2012 re-election. Whatever were John's true feelings, he masked them to us on PCAST with anecdotes about Obama's enthusiasm for the role of science on other issues. John did not have cabinet rank. That would come to a science advisor only in the Biden administration. But he attended cabinet meetings, sitting in the cabinet room with other senior advisors in an outer ring of seats. He learned to be at all times prepared to speak on all issues with technical content, because Obama sometimes called on him impromptu. "John, please explain that to everyone," Obama might say, and John would have to deliver a lecture to cabinet officers whose interest in science was mostly nil. Obama was sometimes intentionally shaming them on that. We eventually did reach an effective working relationship with the president, although it took more work. It helped when we began to have a steady stream of reports ready for release and could run by him in each case our explicit action recommendations. We weren't necessarily looking for his point-by-point approval, but rather for his ideas on follow-up actions that could increase their impact, thoughts he freely gave. It was a curious inversion, his advising us instead of the other way around. A lesson we quickly learned was that we had to anticipate obvious next steps and to take them before meeting with the president. This first came up in a report with recommendations addressed to several cabinet departments. "Well, what do they think?" Obama asked. We were deer in the headlights. "Who?" we asked. He meant the secretaries of X, Y, and Z. They didn't necessarily have to agree with our recommendations, but but we shouldn't waste presidential meeting time when knowing their views was an obvious prerequisite to any action. I came to understand the presidency as a job akin to CEO of a large global corporation, one with many freestanding subsidiaries. Here, the cabinet departments and federal agencies. A good CEO didn't micromanage actions many levels down across those lines. He or she set and communicated high-level policy, urged, guided, signaled favor or disfavor, gave advice, and very occasionally hired or fired senior people. But in this model, a complication for presidents in the White House was the political necessity of preserving exactly the opposite illusion, that the president was a forceful leader who personally decided all government actions and could right any wrong. It made a noticeable difference in the relationship when we began meeting the president in the West Wing's Roosevelt Room. Although nicely furnished, this was a cramped, windowless meeting room, but it was just across the hall from the Oval Office. In some subliminal way, that seemed to make us part of the insider team instead of, in the ceremonial rooms at the other end of the West Colonnade, outside experts. We got used to following John Holdren, in single file like a line of kindergartners, into the basement west entrance, then up the narrow stairs to the windowless, claustrophobic reception vestibule with its single Marine guard and single receptionist. This cramped area was lined with about half a dozen chairs, like a dentist's waiting room. This was where people waited. There wasn't anywhere else to see the leader of the free world. The Warner Bros. Set for the TV show The West Wing replaced the vestibule with a grand marble lobby and enlarged all the other West Wing rooms by a factor of two at least. The humble reality of the actual West Wing would not have been believable to TV audiences. Over time, we learned to interpret the president's reactions to our report presentations as a grade. If he said, "Thank you, that's very interesting," the grade was a C. If he said, "Here's what you should do," and rattled off a list of people whom we should talk to and actions that we should take, the grade was a B. If he said, "Let's do that," and turned to a senior advisor with, "Valerie or Brian, please follow up on this and get back to me," then the grade was an A. That these close senior advisors were now in the room at all was an indication that we as a group were being taken seriously. The A grade meant that we had crystallized something that now, in Obama's mind, was ready for action. It could never be something completely new. It had to have what was called heritage. Our report might give a round boulder its final push over the top of the hill. The B grade was a license for us to continue pressing the issue in public or within government. Our report on radio spectrum allocation got a B grade from Obama, but became effective by virtue of Mark Gornberg's hard follow-up work with FCC staff. When Craig Mundy and I spearheaded a cybersecurity report, some of its recommendations were taken up by White House cybersecurity czar Michael Daniel and his deputy Andy Osmond. For example, that federal agencies should get rid of the 10 years obsolete Windows XP operating system. Craig, as a Microsoft senior executive, was in something of a delicate position. Junking Windows XP would mean the federal government's purchasing new licenses for its replacement, Windows 7, a windfall to Microsoft of hundreds of millions of dollars. But he was Microsoft's top-level liaison to NSA, with high-level security clearances. Craig knew better than anyone that Windows XP was a security disaster whose flaws were being exploited by foreign intelligence services. A different cyber recommendation of ours was that the Securities and Exchange Commission should mandate routine public reporting of cybersecurity incidents under their existing authority to require publicly held firms to report investor risks. The existing SEC position was that a cyber incident had to be material to the company's survival, an impossibly high bar. Craig and I met with two high SEC staffers and got a frostily patronizing lecture about the SEC's status as an independent agency that didn't take advice from anyone. Then, slowly over years, we watched the SEC's position slowly change in the direction that we, and later, with increasing weight, others recommended. Obama's C grade meant you're wasting your time. These reports of ours were issued publicly. By law, all of our completed reports had to be, but never went anywhere. I put my heart into leading a report on the status of the U.S. scientific enterprise, working on it for more than a year. Its release event, with speeches by Holdren, Chuck Vest, and NSF Director Subra Suresh was favorably reported in the science and higher ed media. Still, it got a C. The problem was that few, if any, of its recommendations were actionable. The many that began "universities should" were DOA. In later years, I was often complimented on this report. People quoted it or plagiarized its prose in their own reports and white papers on that perennial subject. Notwithstanding, as presidential advice, it was a complete flop. I was personally targeted by the Obama glare only once in 2012 in connection with this same star-crossed report. I had 3 minutes on our agenda and exactly 3 talking points. 10 seconds into my first point, Obama said, "I get it. Next point." I just didn't believe he had gotten it. My great punchline for this first point was just 2 sentences ahead, and I continued toward it. That was when I got the glare and an icy, "I said, I get it. Please go on to your next point." I did. Again, skipping forward, Obama got used to us, and we got used to him, and our meetings took on a much less formal character. He was very smart, and we learned not to waste his time. He learned some of our names, not mine, I think, and that he could let his hair down and tell us what he really thought about some issues. White House photographer Pete Souza often took pictures during PCAST meetings. It is informative to compare an early one in the state dining room with a late one in the Roosevelt room. In the former, Obama is flashing his campaign grin, and we are sitting stiffly, our faces respectful and serious. In the latter, Obama is slouched back in his chair looking unhappy, while, across the table, John Holdren is standing and wagging an outstretched finger at him. The rest of us are in various poses that range from laughter to disapproval. Our good relations with the president earned us the perk of an all-day visit to Camp David. An overnight stay, or a visit while the president was in residence, would have been far above our station. For form's sake, we held a brief, non-public PCAST meeting, this in one of the well-appointed cabins that figured prominently in the 1978 Sadat Begin negotiations. A plaque on the wall explained this. But mostly it was a junket, and we had free run of the facility. The helpful Navy enlisteds who staffed the place, Camp David was technically a Navy base, set each of us up with an electric golf cart for getting around. In the president's absence, there were no security restrictions. By tradition, every president sponsored a signature addition to Camp David. Obama's was an indoor basketball court. Some PCAST members shot hoops for bragging rights. I raced my cart around the whole perimeter road inside the high fence, several miles circumference. There were walking paths through dense woods in which I tried to spot the camouflaged surveillance and security sensors that I was sure must be there. I didn't see any. The real highlight was the visit to the Shangri-La gift shop in Hickory Lodge, where we all bought Camp David logo t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, medallions, etc. Collectively, we dropped several $1,000s on souvenirs. With a candor that surprised us, Vice President Biden once said to us about Obama after the latter had left the room, "This man is a good president, but he could have been a great president." Biden elaborated on his thesis. Technology progress, this the connection to PCAST business, left groups of people behind. Manufacturing had gone overseas. Unions had lost influence. Middle-aged factory workers could no longer count on lifting their families securely into the middle class. Obama, Biden said, hadn't succeeded at providing a vision for these people, a light at the end of the tunnel. It wasn't sufficient to create job training programs that were beneath the dignity of the people who needed them. It didn't help to tell people that, in a global economy, realistically, manufacturing in the U.S. was gone forever. Obama campaigned on hope, Biden reminded us. The president wasn't delivering hope to these people who needed it. At the time, we were shocked at the vice president's seeming disloyalty to his boss, his talking so freely to outsiders like us. Later, after Donald Trump won the 2016 election, I came to understand Biden's rant to us not as disloyalty, but as a frustrated prognostication. Chapter 67. Alice and Bob. In the holiday period between Thanksgiving and New Year's, when my external academic world slowed to a crawl, I liked to investigate an offbeat recreational topic and then write an explanatory paper for posting on my webpage. One Christmas, I wrote about Albrecht Dürer's famous magic square, which provided the plot resolution for Dan Brown's pulp thriller The Lost Symbol. Another year, It was a subtle method for finding mathematical coincidences, formulas that looked and were impossible but numerically convincing. A simple example was p equals 12 5 log 889 2 e minus 4, which is false but true to 16 digits. Another year, I found a simple model for U.S. income inequality that could predict with good statistical accuracy how many individuals would file tax returns showing incomes at various stratospheric levels. Yet another year, I developed a new algorithm and computer program for calculating the winner in a so-called Condorcet election. And yet another was a paper on distorted cartographic maps, the kind that, e.g., makes states' map areas proportional to their populations or any other variable, like their number of members in the National Academy of Sciences, where the U.S. became two bloated coasts with nothing between. None of these investigations were profound, or even good enough to submit to a reputable journal. Nor did I expect anything different in 2011, when my chosen topic was the Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma game, known as IPD. Some background explanation is helpful. The game imagines that Alice and Bob are both arrested on suspicion of committing a serious crime. The detective questions them in separate rooms. Each has sworn not to betray the other, here termed cooperate, meaning with each other, not with the detective. "I already have enough evidence to convict you both of a misdemeanor," the detective says to each. "That will put you away for 1 year, but if you defect and rat out your partner, I'll let you go scot-free. Your partner will get a felony conviction, 6 years in the pen." "What if we both defect?" Alice and Bob each ask. "Well, I can't let you both go free," the detective says. "You'll each get 3 years." Alice reasons as follows. There are only two possibilities. Either Bob will cooperate with her, or else he'll defect to the detective. If he defects, then she'll get 6 years, unless she defects also, in which case she'll get just 3 years. So, if he rats, it is better for her to rat too. But what if Bob doesn't rat? Then she can still rat on him and be out immediately. So either way, she is better off defecting. Bob employs the same reasoning and rats out Alice. They each get 3 years. They spend the time wishing that they had both kept their promises not to betray each other and escaped with misdemeanor convictions. This seeming paradox is known as the prisoner's dilemma, or PD. IPD differs from PD only in that Alice and Bob play the game not once, but repeatedly. Perhaps, after both keep defecting for a time, they'll wise up and start both cooperating. That idea is grandly named the evolution of cooperation. It is much studied by evolutionary biologists because cooperation is observed in many species in the natural world. IPD, as a mathematical model for the evolution of cooperation, was widely studied in the 1960s and 1970s. The famous political scientist Robert Axelrod called it the E. coli of social psychology, meaning everyone's favorite laboratory model. Based on computer experiments and actual trials with college undergraduates, Axelrod conjectured that the optimal strategy for IPD was some variant of what he called tit for tat. If on the previous round your opponent cooperated, then you should cooperate on the present round. If he defected then you should defect now. In other words, punish a defection with a defection, but only one. I thought it odd that 40 years later, there was in the literature still no mathematical demonstration that tit for tat, or any variant, was in fact optimal. That assertion remained only conjecture. I hope that with vastly more computer power than was available to Axelrod, just on my laptop, I would be able to straightforwardly calculate the game's so-called Nash equilibrium, the optimal strategy for both players. Here, omitting the details, I reframed the problem as one that any computational scientist could recognize as a numerical saddle point optimization on an eight-dimensional hypercube. I then wrote a computer code to solve exactly that problem. In real time, I watched the progress of the optimization on my computer. The program seemed to be approaching a Nash equilibrium until it crashed. I tried again, starting from a different point. Again, the program crashed, but at a different position in the hypercube. I automated the procedure and ran the program 1,000 times and got 1,000 crashes. But I found they weren't at random points. All of the crashes occurred on a particular four-dimensional hyperplane. I traced their cause to a faulty assumption in my program. It assumed that when Bob changed his strategy, there would be some effect on his own average performance, and similarly for Alice. How could this not be true? Apparently it wasn't. The computer could find instances but not explain them. Freeman Dyson was then 88 years old, but I knew that I needed his help. The exact complement to computer intelligence, as yin to yang, was Freeman Dyson intelligence. Over 30 years of Jason Summer studies, I had gotten good at taking problems to just the right level of well-posedness to engage Freeman's mathematical genius. Within Jason, I was considered a kind of Dyson expert in this regard. Word of this had gotten out, and I contributed several quotes, some for attribution, some definitely not, to a 2009 New York Times Magazine profile of Freeman. Now, I emailed Dyson a description of my puzzling results. A week later, he sent back a note with the general result all worked out. When the confusion was hacked away, it came down to a simple equation in high school algebra. Hidden within my hypercube and overlooked in 50 years of research on IPD was the mathematical fact that Alice had the ability, by a certain strategy, to herself dictate Bob's score. No matter how Bob played, that score on average would be his outcome. And Bob, correspondingly, could do the same thing to Alice. Game theorists already had a name for this situation, an ultimatum game. Each player could present to the other an ultimatum. This will be your score. Game theorists had no idea that there was an ultimatum game hidden inside IPD. An even more striking variant was that either player could cause their own reward, avoided jail time, say, to be a multiple of the other player's, an unfairly extortionate result, in other words. It was only a short jump to the realization that in this circumstance, the outcome of the game was influenced by whether each player had a theory of mind about the other. Psychologists use the term theory of mind to mean the ability to attribute mental states, such as belief and intention, to others. Noticing that Alice's winnings are always five times his own, Bob thinks, "I am being extorted. I will temporarily sacrifice to make us both get zero. 5 times 0 is 0. I have a theory of mind about Alice. She'll notice this and not like it. Then we can negotiate." But Bob may be wrong about Alice. She may have put her extortion strategy on autopilot and then disappeared. Bob signaling can only hurt himself. His best option is to accede to the extortion and take the meager winnings that Alice allows him. "Press and I have solved the prisoner's dilemma game," Dyson told people jocularly. "The winning strategy is to go to lunch. I wrote up our paper over Christmas vacation." Josh Plotkin, whom I had first known as a Packard fellow, and Harvard game theorist Drew Feudenberg were referees for PNAS. The paper was published in mid-2012 and caused a stir. People reacted with surprising emotion. Science writer Bill Poundstone suggested applications to abusive marriages, terrorism, the then-current U.S. congressional deadlock, and income inequality. A blogger wrote, "This and similar quant nonsense is precisely what has led to the too-big-to-fail banking disaster we are currently confronting. These studies are worse than useless. They are parasitic cancers on society." Elsewhere, a kinder blogger wrote, "Once again, physicists invade a field and add value." Even that seemed barbed. As I write today, more than 200 papers have been published on one or another aspect of our zero-determinant strategies. Neither Freeman nor I did any further work in game theory. I was never sure what lesson could be drawn from all this. That a couple of physicists with complementary abilities, the more senior, 88 years old, could invade a field and over a holiday vacation find an undiscovered nugget capable of attracting such attention may say something about serendipity or about the genius of Freeman Dyson. Or it may suggest that subfields of science can easily become too set in their ways, and that the scientific enterprise should seek institutional mechanisms that encourage more cross-fertilization across scientific boundaries. A couple of years after our paper, the Institute for Advanced Study held a celebration in honor of Freeman's 90th birthday, to which I was invited as a speaker, to recount the above story of what was thought likely to be Freeman's last mathematical paper, although he did continue to write book reviews. I accepted on condition that Jeffrey and I could stay at Marquand House, which was otherwise being reserved for the IAS trustees and big donors. Freeman was consulted, and we were given a very nice room. After many decades, Mrs. Moriarty had retired as the Marquand housekeeper. Her replacement had the updated title of house manager. Breakfasts were offered at staggered times so that each could be cooked to order. Our time slot found us sharing the breakfast table with billionaire Charles Simonyi and not quite as rich Danny Hillis. In the 1980s, Simonyi had founded Microsoft's Applications Group and wrote the first version of a word processor that became Microsoft Word. He was also famous as a space tourist, paying the Russian Space Agency twice for visits to the International Space Station. Hillis, whom I had last interacted with on CSTB and at his Thinking Machines Corp in the 1990s, and who was the brother of my UT colleague David Hillis, was volubly telling Simonyi about his long now foundation and the construction of a purely mechanical clock with a 200-foot pendulum length that would keep time for 10,000 years, powered by temperature fluctuations. When he mentioned bran, it was not the breakfast cereal on the table, but Bran Ferren. Bill, said with awe, was not me. I was an uncredited extra in this movie, but you know who, that founder of Microsoft. It seemed that no last names were necessary among billionaires. Simonyi said very little, but somehow, during the meal, he took a liking to Jeffrey. He silently followed her around most of the day during the breaks between talks. When she and I took our provided box lunches to an out-of-the-way bench to eat an almost intimate meal, Simonyi sat down next to her with his own box lunch and said nothing, not a word, the whole time she and I were eating and conversing. As I now write, he is the excellent chair of the IAS board. I continued to send Freeman occasional math problems of interest to me. He generally responded with thanks, but no further results. In his 90s, he continued to attend the Jason Summer Studies. He didn't bill for his daily stipend as the rest of us did, or, as far as I could tell, do much. My reputation as a Dyson expert continued to spread in the media, however. I think this annoyed Freeman, since, although we had worked together now and then in Jason for 30 years, we were never really friends. I can't recall even a single conversation with him about anything remotely personal, although Jeffrey had many such conversations with Immy. But when Dyson died in 2020 at the age of 96, several publications, taking for granted that we had been personally close, asked me to write obituaries or remembrances of some kind. Some years earlier, I had written a warm biographical remembrance of Harold Agnew for the journal PNAS. George Dyson, Freeman's son, sent me a photograph of the handwritten page of mathematics that was on top on Freeman's desk at IAS the day he died, seemingly the last thing he was working on. It related to a problem in the statistics of inheritance of polygenic traits that I had sent to him 10 months earlier. I felt that there was a debt of irony that I somehow needed to work off. Over the years I had, I was sure, casually claimed to have read each of Freeman's many popular books, but in fact, I had bothered to read only one or two. Now, I bought them all from used book websites, used an X-Acto knife to slice them into loose pages, and scanned all the pages into my computer. After I cross-indexed all the files for word search, I could read all the books in order of publication and cross-reference every later use of the same anecdotes in later books. Freeman did tend to reuse his own best material. His source became clear only in 2018 with his publication of a volume of his lifelong weekly letters to his mother and sister. All the best anecdotes were there, contemporaneously recorded. During the COVID-19 lockdown, on a 12-hour drive straight through from Austin to our house in Los Alamos, at that time a safer place to isolate, I listened to almost that many hours of Freeman's recorded interviews and oral histories. If before I was only pretending to be a Dyson expert, now I felt genuinely to be one. I wrote a 1,000-word obituary for Physics Today, a 5,000-word piece for Inference, and, with Anne Finkbeiner, a science writer and friend who had written a book on Jason and also knew Freeman well, a 7,000-word biographical memoir for publication by the National Academy of Sciences. Unlike some other biographers, Anne and I did not avoid the dodgy issues of Freeman's strange pantheism, his teleological belief that the universe bent to a purpose, and his heretical stance on the reality of global climate change. We built a case that these were all related, that Freeman was at heart a mystic. With trepidation, we ran our draft past George Dyson. He objected to nothing, and by way of thanks, I sent him my cross-indexed all Dyson database file. Chapter 68, Elections. When I was 12 or 13, my father gave me a copy of Leo Szilard's recently published book of gentle science fiction stories, The Voice of the Dolphins. Frank had met the Szilard, now most remembered for drafting Einstein's letter to FDR that led to the atomic bomb, at a PSAC meeting in Washington. In substance, the stories were wry political satire, at the time far over my head, but several of them developed one of Szilard's favorite themes, that aging scientists hold back, rather than advance, scientific progress, and that their negative influence is best mitigated by inducing them to spend their time on honorific but meaningless committees. Szilard's Dolphins came to my mind 50 years later in 2010, when Alan Leshner, the long-serving executive director and CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, telephoned to ask if I would be willing to stand for election as president of AAAS, pronounced by all as AAAS, the organization that billed itself as the world's largest general scientific society. It was a fluke that I was even a member of AAAS. Anyone could join for $100 a year, and membership provided the benefit of a paper subscription to the weekly science magazine. Before electronic publishing and university site desktop licenses, joining the AAAS was the only way to subscribe to this top scientific journal, so most of AAAS's 100,000 active memberships existed on its rolls for that reason alone. I joined the AAAS when, at Texas, I started pretending to be a biologist. I knew that biologists all read science. 3 years later, the issues piled up on my desk made me eligible to run for the association's top job. AAAS existed on three non-intersecting parallel planes. The magazine was on one. Its professional staff, many of them lifers, jealously guarded a haughty independence from the rest of the organization. A second plane was significant only inside the DC Beltway, practically invisible elsewhere. AAAS was a ready host for soft money, government agency-sponsored projects in science policy that could not find a home at a university. Soft money meant that entrepreneurial individuals who got such funding became AAAS professional staffers for exactly as long as they had funds to pay their own salaries, as well as paying the overhead charged for their space. AAAS occupied a modern, architecturally impressive building in the center of downtown Washington, the gift of financier Bill Golden, who was for 30 years the association's treasurer, and whom I had known as a member of Harvard's Astronomy Department Visiting Committee when I was chair. On a third parallel plane, AAAS was a professional scientific society with 24 self-governing sections in disciplines ranging from the more traditional astronomy, physics, chemistry, and so on, to agriculture, dentistry, societal impacts, and even general interest in science. In none of these fields was it the top professional society, but even so, it offered opportunities for otherwise idle scientists. Szilard would have been proud. Each section had its own officers, committees, and annual agendas of make work. AAAS annual meetings were held in large convention centers, a different city each year, and typically hosted 120 separate sessions, with also invited plenary talks by famous people. Attendance was in the many thousands. The fragility of AAAS governance was that the organization's standing on two of its planes depended on its having elected officers and board members with national and international name recognition, but its election process tended to produce boards mixed in reputation and accomplishment. Add to this the peculiarity of the so-called presidential line. Members, those who actually bothered to vote, a small minority of science subscribers, elected not a president, but a president-elect who would serve for 1 year, advance to president for a second year, and become board chair in their third and final year. The other board members had four-year terms. Like me, individuals in the AAAS presidential line often had little previous involvement with the organization. They parachuted in, briefly lent their name, and departed, with an unwritten lifetime obligation to continue contributing to the annual fund. Perhaps not so bluntly as the above, but still very clearly, Alan Leshner explained this all to me in his telephone call. He also made clear that he, not the presidential line or the board, actually ran the organization, so I needn't worry that I might actually have to do anything. Leshner was a well-known and well-liked presence around Washington. He had an unpretentious, folksy manner, was excellent on panels, and could always make any audience laugh. He was the Jewish uncle that you never knew you had, but immediately loved. Not unlike other uncles, he also made sure you knew certain things about him. For example, that he was the second highest paid scientist inside the Beltway. Only the CEO of the industry-dominated American Chemical Society made slightly more, at the time about $1 million a year. And anyway, Allen's telephone pitch to me concluded, you won't get elected. I would be running against a charismatic female candidate who was sure to win. That was good enough for me, and I accepted the nomination. But while the other candidate may have been charismatic, she turned out to be also controversial. To everyone's surprise, I won. My first election victory since student council in junior high school. I would be the 165th president of the AAAS. Alice Huang was outgoing chair in my year as president-elect. In 1980s Cambridge, her and David Baltimore's daughter Teak was a school friend of Sarah's, and Alice now felt free to give me her unvarnished advice on matters large and small. Small. The shortest path from the Willard Intercontinental Hotel to the AAAS building took advantage of a diagonal block at the Inter-American Development Bank to save 20 seconds walk. Leshner always had the board put up at five-star hotels. Large. A lot of things at AAAS needed fixing, and Leshner wasn't going to lead in fixing them. It would take concerted effort by all three in the presidential line, and a lot of arm-twisting of the board, to get any kinds of reforms even started. And unfortunately, serving between Alice and me in line, that year as president, was Nina Fedorov. Known as someone who rarely cooperated with anyone on anything, and, in fact, on leave in Saudi Arabia at King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. During the 2 years that Nina and I overlapped, she rarely attended board meetings. Every new AAAS president gives a plenary address to some thousands of people at that year's annual meeting. Held in Chicago that year, Rahm Emanuel, then mayor, was on the plenary's agenda to welcome the thousands of us. He arrived with police escort at the convention center with only minutes to spare. Backstage, I introduced myself as the plenary session's chair. What do you want? He said. I didn't know what he meant. Was I supposed to ask for something? Kickback for bringing in the business? A patronage job in the Department of Sanitation? What do you want? He repeated impatiently. I got it. He wanted me to write his speech for him. I reeled off. Welcome, Chicago. Industry, technology, basic science, educating the next generation, Great University of Chicago, Enrico Fermi, then to Fermilab now. Keep doing all your good works. He stopped me and went on stage to deliver a polished 10-minute welcome, elaborating on all of my points and coming across as meticulously prepared. Phil Sharp, Jerry Fink, and I, the presidential line in my final year, did succeed in getting Alan Leshner to initiate some modest efforts at change. For example, chartering an internal committee that could possibly, at some indefinite future time, actually produce a strategic plan for the organization. He announced this to the full board with great fanfare, and at the same meeting, took Phil, Jerry, and me aside to tell us that he intended to retire in a year, but that we were not authorized to tell a single other soul. It was his way of telling us to get off his back, that nothing was going to happen of any consequence in his or our remaining time. Alan did retire, to praise from all quarters for his long service to AAAS, the nation, and science. Did I accomplish nothing at AAAS? Not quite. It was on my watch that Bruce Alberts decided to step down as editor-in-chief of Science, a job he had taken after finishing his term as NIAS president. Bruce did the work part-time from California, at most a few hours a week, leaving almost all decisions to his full-time managing editor in Washington. His extraordinarily generous salary was set by Leshner. I chaired the search committee to find his replacement. Science had been coasting on past reputation and was now far behind its international competitor, Nature. I insisted that we look for someone who would do the job full-time and be aggressive about making changes, even if they lacked the prestige of a former NAS president. Alan, on the committee, was skeptical that we could find any good scientist willing to make such an irreversible career shift. Mostly, he was right. Candidates whom we approached were uniformly enthusiastic, that is, about doing the job part-time, staying in their existing labs, and getting paid like Bruce. Marcia McNutt was an exception. As director of the U.S. Geological Survey, she was an Obama political appointee who would in any case be out of a job when Obama's second term ended in less than 3 years. With originally a PhD from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, she had risen to full professor in Frank's department at MIT. I knew Marcia from that time, but better from her job after that, as director of the Packard-supported Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, where she was often at the annual Packard Fellows meetings. Marcia's reputation in science was more the doer than the theorizer. While in graduate school, she qualified in a Navy SEALs training program in underwater demolition and explosives handling. She competed in rodeos, barrel racing. At MIT, she ran the joint oceanographic program with Woods Hole, doing 15 expeditions, chief scientist on half of them. She was in the process of reorganizing USGS with an energy not there seen in 50 years. She had been the government's senior on-the-ground official in Houston for many weeks during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I was not surprised when the search committee's reaction to Marcia was mixed. The problem, never openly articulated by either the men or the women on the committee, was her appearance. You could describe Marcia as glamorous, with straw blonde hair, piercing blue eyes, and a perfect smile. Or you could see her as, well, inappropriately dressed in tight clothes with revealing necklines, too short skirts, stiletto heels, or, maybe worse, decorated cowboy boots. Marcia's appearance would not have been out of place as a hostess in a Las Vegas cocktail lounge, an upscale one to be sure. She was a rarity, at least then, a woman scientist who dressed exactly the way she wanted to and didn't give a fuck about what other people thought. The eccentricity of Marcia's appearance had no effect on her manner, which was always businesslike and direct. She was a killer change agent in a tight pencil skirt. It was hard to bring the search committee around, especially when none were willing to say what all were thinking, that she didn't look like the editor-in-chief of a preeminent scientific journal. Detractors on the committee were sure that no one who looked like that could write well. I had to phone Marcia to ask apologetically for a writing sample. "Well, I do a weekly letter to our 8,000 USGS employees. Would that do?" She submitted a dozen of these, which proved to be well-written essays on all manner of scientific and administrative topics. I was relieved when the committee agreed to offer her the job, the more so when she accepted it. My involvement with AAAS ended soon after that, as did, I thought, my professional entanglement with McNutt's career. But, as it turned out, it was only a hiatus. In 2015, I was asked to serve on NASA's Nominations Committee for Counselors, Officers, and, this happened less often than once a decade, a new NAS president. Then-President Ralph Cicerone had quietly asked the NAS Council to shorten his second 6-year term by a year. In fact, Ralph looked terrible, but he affected surprise and indignation when anyone asked about his health. "He was fine," he always said. In the event, he died less than 6 months after stepping down, at age 73, with no cause of death ever announced. I was a known quantity for the NAS Nominations Committee. I had been on it 3 times before. First, 11 years earlier when Cicerone was nominated, then a year later as chair, with only council members, not officers, elected in that round, and again, a few years after that, when Barbara Shaw was elected to her second term as Academy Vice President. Barbara was now to be chair of this new nominations committee. Together on PCAST, she had become one of my best friends, and she had been on the AAAS nominating committee that proposed me for that association's president. I always found the degree of inbreeding at this level of scientific leadership staggering, even while benefiting from it. Because every NAS scientific section was allocated a member, it was a huge committee, 25 in all. At the first meeting, before any possible names for president were even mentioned, Barbara took me aside. "We think it's about time to have a woman as NAS president." Guessing that the 8 women on the committee were telepathically linked, I didn't have to ask who we were. "I'm with you," I said. I don't know who else she lined up in so direct a fashion. Nothing was said in the presence of the full committee, but I think Shaw soon secretly had the necessary 13 fully committed votes. After that, it would be just process, lengthy but foreordained. We did still have to find the woman, however. Luckily, by a quirk of the NAS election process, we only needed one. While all offices other than president were decided in contested elections with two candidates, for NAS president, the nominations committee's single candidate was submitted to a yes-no vote of the membership. The president position was a demanding full-time job in Washington for as long as 12 years. Finding two candidates to so commit, one of whom would then very publicly lose, had been long ago rejected as impractical. At home, Jeffrey told me that the choice ought to be Marcia. But what about her clothes? She just always looks great, Jeffrey said dismissively. But when I mentioned Marcia privately to Barbara, who dressed conservatively and was by now a dean at her university, she looked doubtful. It might be cool to have a fashion-minded Las Vegas cocktail hostess as the public face of the NAS, but the world might not be ready for that. There were other highly qualified women candidates, but in the end, in the final round, none were willing to be considered for the job. There was no shortage of willing male candidates, but none were standouts. Over a lengthy 6-month process with multiple interviews, McNutt emerged on the merits as the clear front runner. Then, unexpectedly, the process stalled. 3 committee members, all male, all respected scientists active in Academy Affairs, announced en bloc that they would not only vote against McNutt, they would actively oppose her, appealing to the NAS Council if necessary to block her nomination. It was extraordinary. Theirs were merely 3 votes out of 25, but they spoke as if they had special standing as secret representatives of a ruling patriarchy that I somehow had not been invited to join, or even know about. The remaining 22 of us were aghast. None of us doubted that unspoken gender discrimination existed, but no one expected it to be so crudely expressed. Ultimately, Barbara forced the vote, and Marcia won decisively. The attempt at a 3-male appeal was decisively rebuffed by the NAS Council, and McNutt became the 22nd president of the National Academy of Sciences, its first female president, in July 2016. With all this high drama, the lesser business of the committee, nominating 2 candidates for a 4-year term as NAS treasurer, a part-time job, should have been an anticlimax. Jerry Ostricker, the outgoing treasurer, had done very little. NAS and its operating arm, the fiscally much larger NRC, had a full-time chief financial officer who had a staff of 100. Other than his or her being an officer on council, the elected treasurer's job was largely ceremonial. We already had a willing and well-qualified candidate, a respected medical school dean who had spent some of his career in big pharma and was thought to be personally wealthy. His research was the basis for a best-selling drug. Still, statutorily, we had to find an additional candidate to run against him and had, thus far, failed. I called several candidates trying to drum up interest, but to no avail. It was getting late in the day and the committee was tired. I stood up and announced that I was going to step out of the room, and that if this gave the committee any ideas about who might be the sacrificial candidate to run against the pharma dean, then that was okay with me. When I came back 10 minutes later, I had been chosen to run. Word must have spread fast through the NAS building. In less than 20 minutes, we heard that Ralph Cicerone wanted to address the committee on the necessary qualifications for treasurer, and after another 10 minutes, he was there. It was very important, he said, looking directly at me, that the new NAS treasurer have industry experience. I couldn't believe it. I had just been nominated, and the president of the National Academy of Sciences was already campaigning against me. It reminded me most of when Scoutmaster Thomason had campaigned against me in my rigged election as patrol leader, and probably for many of the same reasons then as now. I think that Ralph, a cautious and possibly unwell man, couldn't stomach the idea of a cocktail hostess as NAS president and a smart-elect dilettante as NAS treasurer, both at the same time. Jerry Ostricker's slack performance as treasurer, he, another astrophysicist, might also have been a factor. Ralph clearly wanted me to withdraw as a candidate, to let the committee define someone else. But we had tried. There wasn't anyone else. Winning the election was a surprise, but less so than AAAS had been. Academy members in Class 2, Life Sciences, didn't know me, but saw that I was listed as a professor of biology, and I was not from Big Pharma. That was enough to split their votes. Members in Class 1, Physical Sciences, knew that I was secretly one of their own and nearly all probably voted for me. Some nonagenarian members probably thought they were voting for my father. I became NAS treasurer the same day that Marcia became president. 3 out of 5 council officers were now women, plus 8 out of 12 council members at large. It seemed to be the beginning of a new era. And then, 4 months later, Donald Trump was elected U.S. president. Chapter 69. Trumped on U.S. Election Day, November 2016, I was sitting in a meeting room in Beijing's Crown Plaza Zhongkun as a participant in CSAC's latest bilateral China discussion. Our Chinese counterparts were by this time familiar faces. We were all seeming friends, while also adversaries. The Chinese participants expressed a moderate interest in the American election, mainly to make a point of their own system's superiority, as they saw it. The permanence of the Chinese Communist Party guaranteed them immunity from any disruptive change. These Chinese, mostly People's Liberation Army affiliated, didn't much differentiate candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. The implied criticism was more generic. You Americans go crazy every 4 years. At least this time, we could counter the accusation. The new Clinton administration would be very much a continuation of Obama's. Hillary's policy advisors were from the same universities and think tanks as Obama's now serving officials. Many of these would stay in government. That Hillary would win the election was simply assumed. During a tea break, I explained to a small Chinese audience that Trump had won his party's nomination by mobilizing a minority of the extreme right who were not typical of the electorate at large, who would reject his extreme views. The polls all comfortably favored Clinton. I went on to explain the so-called Blue Wall, the union-heavy, solidly Democratic states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. My Chinese colleagues' eyes glazed over. They had less interest in the demographics of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin than we would have had in Hebei, Hubei, and Henan. To them, I was an Obama political appointee, a kind of low-level, bureaucrat Mandarin, unless I was also an intelligence agent under academic cover, to them a possibility. My formal presentation to the current session could support both hypotheses. I gave a historical lecture on the intricacies of the legal interface between U.S. military and U.S. civilian cyber, both offense and defense. The Chinese interest in Title 10 versus Title 50 and in posse comitatus was even less than their interest in Wisconsin dairy politics. The rock star of these 2016 cyber talks was Chris Inglis, our team's recently retired deputy director of the National Security Agency, NSA. Likely in part the result of the Snowden reveals, the PLA had embarked on a multi-year plan to consolidate and modernize its cyber forces, both offensive, which publicly didn't exist, and defensive. At breaks, the Chinese peppered Chris with questions about exactly how NSA and U.S. Cyber Command were organized and how the two interacted. They were visibly surprised at Inglis's willingness to answer. His answers had a military directness, no posse comitatus obfuscation from him. This wasn't loose lips. U.S. doctrine was that mutual transparency in military structure and order of battle was strategically stabilizing. NSA leadership wanted nothing better than to have a Chinese NSA with exactly its same structure, so that they would know exactly who were their opposite numbers and could communicate with them in time of crisis to avoid misunderstandings and escalations. Thanks to Track 1, Mil-Mil exchanges, contact information was already exchanged in some military realms other than cyber. Our Track 2 exchange was trying to move the needle in the cyber realm. Because of the 12-hour time zone difference, late evening election returns were for us late morning. While pretending to listen to Chinese presentations on expected norms of cyber military operations aimed purely at the U.S. because they didn't admit to having such operations, we watched our mobile phones with increasing horror. Although the Chinese Great Firewall blocked direct internet connections to most U.S. news sites, China Telecom tunneled the internet packets of foreign mobile phones directly to the foreign carrier, also maybe keeping a copy for themselves. I alternated between the CNN and New York Times sites. Around 11 a.m., Florida and North Carolina were called for Trump, contrary to pre-election polling. The blue wall fell, starting with Pennsylvania, during our elaborate lunch banquet in the hotel restaurant. At the afternoon session, the Americans were ashen-faced. The Chinese were polite and triumphant. This was full circle from our 2013 meeting, at which they, the Chinese, were rendered mute by the Snowden revelations of U.S. information dominance. Back home, the weekly PCAST leadership telephone meetings provided glimpses of the Obama-Trump transition through OSTPIs. With their staffs, Holdren's OSTP associate directors, environment, national security, science, technology, prepared handoff memos and filled thick, loose-leaved briefing books with tutorial white papers, government org charts, and the names, job descriptions, and phone contacts of the career civil servants who would span the two administrations. Then, they waited for visits from their opposite numbers on the Trump team. Those contacts never came. The experience of the National Security Council staff was much the same, as was that at OMB. In the sense of any modern presidential campaign, there simply was no policy infrastructure on the Trump side. It was painfully clear that the Trump people had never really expected to win and had made no plans for the eventuality. By contrast, Clinton's campaign had dozens of policy committees covering all subjects, each ready to fission into formal transition teams who would vet individuals for jobs and the ambitious subset looking to be appointed. The number of Schedule C presidential appointments throughout the government, these below the level requiring Senate confirmation, was more than 1,000. Apart from the small number of dog whistle issues that Trump had campaigned on, anti-immigrant, anti-abortion, anti-regulation, and so on, there were no Trump policy advisors other than the Trump children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. And, figuratively, the more thumb-worn cards in the Fox News Rolodex. The Schedule C vacuum was so big and decision-making in the Trump White House so dysfunctional that it took the first half of Trump's term for the vacuum to fill. And when it did so with opportunists, refugees from Fox News, Federalist Society zealots, and many pure loonies, including, sadly, a couple of my former colleagues. I always thought myself well-informed on American history. I could think of no parallel to this since Andrew Jackson's invasion of the White House. Jackson ended up being treated more favorably by history than he perhaps deserved. I can't imagine any such redemption for Donald Trump. PCAST had its final meeting with President Obama in January, a couple of weeks before Inauguration Day. Some of us were crying. Our 8 years of offering advice to the president now came down to his advising, that is, consoling us. He must have had dozens of similar meetings with other groups and had settled on a few comforting aphorisms. Progress doesn't travel in a straight line. It zigs and zags and fits and starts, he reassured us. It sounded like a quote, and when I Googled, I found that he had used this line in a speech 4 years earlier when Democrats had failed to retake the House. He was non-committal to us about his future plans, nor did he say anything about maintaining any level of contact. Behind the aphorisms, he seemed done. And, reportedly, he was disgusted with the Clinton campaign's failure to have taken advice from either him or Bill Clinton, two of the greatest retail campaigners in recent history. A few days after this meeting, we received individual emails from the White House personnel office telling us how and where to send in our resignation letters, which were due a week before the inauguration. We floated among ourselves the idea of not resigning. Legally, PCAST was chartered under the Federal Advisory Committee Act. That law was clear. FACA committee appointments didn't automatically expire at the end of an administration. We knew that lower-level committees at NSF and NASA were continuing. What then if we didn't resign and continued meeting as before? Would anyone in the Trump White House even notice? But some spoilsport leaked the nascent and not entirely serious plan to OSTP, and we soon received a new email from the personnel office clarifying that if we didn't resign, we would on January 19th be formally fired for cause and thereby be ineligible for any future federal employment. Obama had decreed that there were to be no dirty tricks by us or anyone. After January 20th, OSTP continued its statutory functions with a skeleton number of career civil servants. Ted Wackler, who had been Holdren's chief of staff, became acting director. Several self-organized groups of prominent scientists tried to find a contact point in the new administration to make the case for science, minimally, that a science advisor to the president should be appointed. Someone knew someone who knew someone who thought they could get an audience with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, but that didn't pan out. The only Trump advisor with any technical chops at all was Peter Thiel, a Silicon Valley billionaire, co-founder of PayPal, who supported libertarian political candidates and gave scholarships for bright kids not to attend college, but to drop out and try their luck as entrepreneurs. Thiel indeed suggested two candidates for science advisor, both extreme climate doubters. Will Happer, my Jason colleague, then approaching age 80, and computer scientist David Gelernter, whose public statements included his view that women should stay home to care for their children. Luckily, neither got the job. For FDA administrator, Thiel's favorite candidate was on record saying that drug regulation did more harm than good. 20 months in, an OSTP director was finally appointed, Oklahoma Secretary of Science and Technology, who knew? Kelvin Drogemeier, who was named at the instigation of Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe. The science community reacted with relief because Drogemeier was an actual and mostly apolitical scientist, and it could have been so much worse. But Drogemeier was never given the parallel appointment of science advisor to the president. Trump never had a science advisor. An anemic PCAST was reconstituted 33 months into the 48-month term, mostly of business executives. Among the few scientists willing or invited to serve was my former Harvard astronomy colleague, Avi Loeb. Avi was so widely disapproved of anyway that this made hardly any difference to his reputation. Will Happer eventually took a short-lived position on the NSC staff. Even he came away disappointed. One night, Jeffrey asked me, taking into account that, from the inside, one can work to mitigate harm, were there any circumstances under which I would serve in the Trump administration if asked? None, I said. Good, she said. That's the right answer. As the anti-science, indeed anti-reason, agendas of the Trump administration came into focus, an increasing number of National Academy members wanted the NAS to denounce the administration's actions. A year into Trump's term, 1,000 NAS members, about half the membership, and including me, signed a statement deploring U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords and the denigration of science and harassment of scientists generally. But this was a statement by individuals, not an official NAS position. Marsha McNutt was in a tight situation. NAS's charter, going back to President Lincoln's wartime need, was to advise the federal government, not just certain administrations that we liked better than others. In heated council meetings, it became clear that a majority of the NAS council wanted the NAS to be a kind of science government in exile, exposing the administration's hypocrisy in fiery public denunciation. Better to be a De Gaulle in London, the argument went, than to be a Pétain in Vichy. I was emotionally sympathetic to this group, but understood that the collateral damage to U.S. science of a war between Trump and the NAS would be huge, a favorite word in Trump's rhetoric. This was essentially also Marsha's position. When the five officers all backed Marsha, enough of the other 12 council members stepped back from the brink to avert a showdown. In fact, NAS NRC business was under Trump booming. Agencies were chartering NRC studies at a record clip, and many new studies were being mandated by Congress. It was another indication that the thin political layer of generally incompetent Trump appointees had little control over their own bureaucracies. Civil servants a few levels down from the top understood that strong NRC recommendations on issues would put their political masters in the position of looking bad if they routinely countermanded them. On the rare occasions that I watched Fox News, usually in hotel rooms, I felt satisfaction at their commentators' rants against the deep state and its obstruction of the supposed will of the American people. I thanked God for the deep state. 2 years into his term, Trump's appointees first sufficiently penetrated the Department of Defense that Jason became visible on their radar. The Jason Program Office at MITRE, Jason's administrative home, received an immediate stop work order from a low-level Pentagon contracting officer. The letter said that DOD was considering more economical alternatives for getting programmatic advice and that no further charges to the Jason contract would be honored. Obvious care had been taken to leave no fingerprints of the individual who actually ordered this action, and it took several days of phoning our friends in the deep state to trace it to Under Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, Michael Griffin, who had been confirmed in office 2 months earlier. Although Griffin had served in previous Republican administrations as an unremarkable NASA head under George W. Bush, for example, he was not particularly doctrinaire or indeed forceful in any way. Why then take sudden aim at Jason? It took more calls to trace the action further to Griffin's deputy, Lisa Porter. Porter had now worked with Griffin as his deputy for nearly two decades at NASA, at CIA's research arm InQtel, and now in DOD. Porter was the power behind the scenes, people told us. Griffin was the front man. It now all made sense, because Porter was a longtime Jason hater. We never knew why. It must have been something in the distant past, but her enmity ran very deep. Now, when she saw a chance to kill us, she took it, except not successfully. Even this late in their term, Trump appointees had not managed to gain control of the quasi-independent National Nuclear Security Agency within the Department of Energy. Much of NNSA's professional staff came from Los Alamos and Livermore, and they held Jason in high regard. Lisa Gordon Haggerty was the Trump administration appointee heading the agency. Her strong nuclear credentials and service in the Bush administration may have misled them. She was no Trumpite. She was deep state, Livermore chapter, to the core. Breaking all records for the speed of government contracting, Jason was soon again alive and well under NNSA sponsorship. We died by the hand of one bureaucrat named Lisa, were resurrected by the hand of another. So, there were a few small battles won. But overall, the effect that Trumpism and resurgent, intolerant populism worldwide had on me and my cohort was spiritually devastating. In Cambridge for my Harvard undergraduate class's 50th reunion, I was put on a panel with the magisterial title, The State of Our Democracy. When my turn came, I grandly intoned that we should all consider the possibility that the world had come to the end of its 400 years of the Enlightenment. What if fact-based decision-making was not the normal human condition? What if the natural state of government was authoritarian? The natural state of economies, monopolist kleptocracies? The natural state within and between nations, tribal conflict? What if the moral universe didn't bend toward justice? It was not the fall of the Roman Empire that we should be thinking about, I said, but the centuries earlier collapse of the Roman Republic, the rise of long-lived autocracy. That seemed to be where American civilization was headed. Sherry Turkle, a classmate also on our panel, in turn helped drive the audience to despair by talking about the commoditization of the individual by big data high tech. At the reception following, the bar ran out of hard liquor. Chapter 70. COVID and Beyond. I was in Washington on February 21, 2020, for a NAS-hosted Wikipedia Edit-a-thon, an organized group of volunteers who met to improve Wikipedia science content. I wasn't a regular member of the group, but I was already going to be in New York for a Simons Foundation board meeting the day before and could easily take the Acela train to D.C. And, under several noms de plume, I had for years been a regular Wikipedia contributor. I had gotten to know Jim Simons, the hedge fund billionaire, after becoming NetAS treasurer. Simons had been elected to NAS membership in the mathematics section a few years before, deservedly for Chern Simons' theory and not for inventing the hedge fund, but his being a billionaire hadn't hurt him any. He had agreed to serve on its investment committee, which 2 years later I came to chair as treasurer. The Simons Foundation in New York City had existed for 20 years as the vehicle for Jim and Marilyn Simons' personal philanthropy, supporting an ambitious program in autism research. Their adult daughter Audrey was autistic, and also a mix of scientific and institutional awards. In the 2010s, the foundation began a conscious shift toward more permanent professionalism. Marilyn Simons' experience on a number of philanthropic boards had made her a proponent of what were thought of as best practices. Jim had less interest in best practices, other than his own, but tolerated Marilyn's with an affectionate deference. He did take an interest in formalities that would nail down the foundation's mission of supporting basic scientific research beyond his own lifetime. I was one of several scientists newly appointed to the Simons Foundation board, along with Shirley Tilghman and Peter Littlewood. At our first board meeting in October 2017, we learned that Jim and Marilyn had amended their binding donor letter to require that a majority of the board be scientists. Getting from NYC to DC was, on this particular February occasion, unpleasant. On a Thursday, at rush hour, the Penn Station waiting room was packed. Freezing outside, the train station was overheated, and a sweaty crowd was standing shoulder to shoulder. The next day's wiki session was less interesting than I had hoped, but at least I was there. The next Monday, back home in Austin, I was in bed, sick with what seemed to be a bad cold, but which laid me out flat for the next 3 days, for me, unusually severe. I was supposed to travel again that week, but I canceled. COVID didn't seem like a possibility, because it was then only in the Seattle area, it was thought. And I didn't have the symptoms that were being talked about: difficulty breathing, loss of sense of smell, anosmia, etc. The first confirmed case of COVID in New York City came a week later, on Leap Year Day, February 29th. I got out of the Big Apple just in time, it seemed. Or did I? The day the word hoarding first appeared in a newspaper article, we rushed to Costco and scored a several-month supply of toilet paper. UT students left for a spring break that was initially extended for a few days, then made permanent for the whole semester. Spring classes would be continued only remotely, using then-newfangled Zoom. By late March, the whole country, the whole world, was on lockdown. When the New York Times made its raw data of COVID cases by county available on GitHub, I plotted a weekly graph of the counties of interest to us, Travis in Texas, and also Dallas and Harris, Houston, for comparison, Los Alamos in New Mexico, but also Santa Fe and Bernalillo, Albuquerque, because in NM, we might end up getting hospitalized in one of those. Isolated at home, I tracked in the news and on less reputable websites the ups and downs of claimed COVID prophylactics and treatments, sorting them into three categories. 1. Certainly wrong and probably harmful. 2. Probably wrong but not harmful. And 3. Possibly real but unproved. President Trump's public suggestion that people inject bleach solution into their veins, later walked back as only kidding, was the poster child in Category 1. But I did enthusiastically stock our household with every nostrum in Categories 2 and 3 that I could get a hold of before supplies were exhausted by crazy people like me. I classified high-dose vitamin D and alpha-lipoic acid food supplements in Category 2. Pepcid, famotidine, acid reducer was in Category 3. Jim Simons was enough of a believer to fund an ongoing clinical trial in a Long Island hospital, which failed for lack of sufficient enrollment, not on its merits. I managed to score 50 grams of non-human-grade hydroxychloroquine at an outrageous price from a fly-by-night chemical supplier, but decided to treat it as Category 1, dangerous, the more so since I had no way to verify what was actually in the bottle. If I had fallen seriously sick in this early period, before vaccines or effective antivirals, I might have tried the Pepcid, I hope not the others, but people were increasingly desperate. By June 2020, my chart showed 5 times as many people, per capita, dying in Austin as in Los Alamos or Santa Fe. Austin hospitals were overflowing. The city was making plans to convert the Austin Convention Center into what was being politely called a field hospital. But really, it would be no more than a large quarantine facility with beds and little else. There were still no effective medical treatments. If you got sick, your chance of dying was 1 or 2%. If you needed hospitalization, it was 10 or 20%. If you were intubated on a respirator, only later understood as inappropriate treatment, it was 50%. Jeffrey and I packed our 2 cars and drove in caravan to New Mexico, stopping only for gas, about a 12-hour drive. We sheltered continuously in our house in Los Alamos until late fall. I largely worked on my autobiography and participated remotely that summer in Jason's minimal, all Zoom and thus all unclassified summer study. We drove back to Austin, again nonstop in caravan, when the mortality statistics had reversed in its favor. Our relief at Biden's narrow victory over Trump in November was indescribable. By this time, it was clear that my February cold might have been COVID after all. It was now known that the virus was circulating in NYC during most of February, and crowded Penn Station would have been a perfect superspreader locus. Long COVID had become a recognized syndrome, and over the summer, my sense of smell had gone seriously off kilter. Not anosmia, loss of the sense, but parosmia, where I perceived many ordinarily good smells as instead a strong odor of sweat socks, or as things not so unpleasant but just as weirdly wrong. There could be other causes of this than long COVID, but Pre-COVID, they were all very rare conditions. A serum antibody test for COVID was negative, but after so many months, the test was not considered reliable. An ENT specialist found nothing to explain the parosmia and had little interest. Normally, we would have traveled back to Los Alamos for the 2020-2021 winter holiday, Jeffrey driving via Lubbock with Lewis the dog, me flying. But my graphs of case statistics showed northern New Mexico now no safer than Travis County. Vaccine was being promised within weeks. We worried that as Texans, per our driver's licenses, we might not be able to get, in New Mexico, vaccine doses allocated to that state. So, we stayed in Austin through the winter. In early 2021, we were among the first to get vaccinated. I was able to get the Pfizer mRNA vaccine through UT, both doses. Although distribution within Texas was chaotic, UT was able to secure a supply. Jeffrey had a harder time. At the dog park a block from our house, she learned of a vaccine angel in our neighborhood, a volunteer young person, isolated in lockdown, who trolled continuously the websites of local clinics and pharmacies looking for available vaccine. There existed a self-organized network of such angels who shared information on the who, what, when, where of vaccine shipments, often by getting tips from other young people working at drugstores and distribution sites. There existed no more formal way to find a shot. Coordination at the county, state, and federal levels was completely broken. Our local angel eventually got Jeffrey an appointment at a Walmart 10 miles away. I had zero reaction to the two vaccine doses, or, later, to the booster shot. Not even a sore arm. Another indication that I might already have had the disease as one of the first. Or maybe not. I'll never know. For the 1 year plus of the pandemic's complete disruption of life, my human contacts populated small squares on Zoom video screens. These were sometimes a source of global intelligence. Early in the lockdown, as the ineffectiveness of the then-Trump administration's response became obvious, John Holdren organized a subset of us former Obama PCAST members for an unofficial PCAST-like role. Chris Castle, Chris Chiba, Susan Graham, Harold Varmus, Eric Lander, Rick Levin, Maxine Savitz, Ed Penhoot, me. On individual topics, the national PPE stockpile, the role of contact tracing, obstacles to public health data flow, the state of computer modeling, and so forth. We interviewed, by Zoom, national and international experts, came to consensus recommendations, and wrote white papers. I was amazed at how everyone we contacted wanted to talk to us. It wasn't that we had any actual authority. There were at least a dozen self-organized groups like ours with comparable claims to legitimacy. The phenomenon was that everyone we contacted wanted to contribute somehow, and given the vacuums in Washington, the White House, and Atlanta, CDC, no one knew exactly where were the fulcrum points or where the loci of effectiveness might turn out to be. So, everyone wanted to talk to everyone. It was chaos trying to self-organize, encouraging, but not efficient. Our group put up a website. Of course, I was the webmaster. We sent our papers individually to Holdren's private email list of powerful, or once powerful, people. House and Senate members, present and former federal officials, media editors and columnists, state government leaders, academicians, and so forth. In various subsets of two or three, we published op-ed pieces. Chris Castle, Sue Graham, and I had an editorial on data in modern healthcare, a widely read trade paper. Rick Levin and I had one on epidemiological modeling in science. All of us signed onto a policy paper drafted by Chris Chiba on the coming need for a formal COVID commission. This was published in Science after a year's delay. Perhaps our efforts had a beneficial effect. It is hard to know. The effort had a beneficial effect on us, at any rate. We old PCAST friends enjoyed getting together on Zoom every week. A sense of camaraderie helped us individually through the pandemic's darkest time. Interestingly, none of us actually caught COVID during this whole period, though we all knew people who had, and knew or knew of people who had died. That anecdotal fact was roughly consistent, numerically, with the pandemic's killing about 1 in 300 Americans. A completely different Zoom group, though with a similar sociology and mode of operation, was organized by Bob Kahn, then retiring as president of Kavli Foundation. Kahn's targets, much more specifically than Opcast, were the various science bills being introduced in Congress. Multiple congressional offices, the most important being Majority Leader Senator Chuck Schumer's, had concluded that a pandemic was the right time to garner public support for a big increase in federal science funding, and not just health-related. Beyond that idea, there was little consensus, however. Should the National Science Foundation be steered into more applied research, less basic? Should NIH have a new DARPA-like organization for less conventional health research? Should we invest in semiconductors and materials, the better to compete with China? Or build quantum computers? Or create new regional research centers, anywhere except California and Massachusetts, and in what areas of technology? Khan assembled a high-profile group that could advertise itself as honest brokers on Capitol Hill. David Baltimore, Mary Sue Coleman, Tom Rosenbaum, Shirley Tilghman, Harold Varmus. Most were current or ex-university presidents. David Spergel and I got added when Khan learned that Jim Simons was close to Schumer and spoke to him regularly. This so-called Khan salon met weekly by Zoom and had Zoom calls with staffers from one or more congressional offices and with carefully matched Democratic and Republican staff from House and Senate committees. The group's work product, not in writing, was the patient, careful explanation to non-scientist staff of the implications, good and bad, of their proposed bill's provisions. I was often reminded of the old adage that legislation was a very blunt instrument and hard to get right. The Khan salon had less camaraderie than Opcast, but I enjoyed seeing Harold Varmus on both groups and Shirley Tilghman, whom I liked a lot, regularly. By mid-2021, it seemed that things were inching back to a new definition of normal. Jason held an in-person summer study in La Jolla, ordinary seeming, except that vaccinations were required and we wore masks and did antigen self-tests at least twice a week. I started traveling again to NASS and Simons activities. There was one Simons event that Jeffrey and I would not have missed, even with the continuing COVID risk. David Spergel was formally installed as the president of the Simons Foundation. Jim and Marilyn remained on the board, but were stepping back from day-to-day foundation affairs. David was going to run the show. Shirley and I had known for a year that this was in the works, known from David in confidence. David had been rumored to be a candidate to succeed Shirley as president of Princeton, but didn't get that job. Simons Foundation president was, in a way, a consolation prize, less visible and prestigious, but a lot more fun. Marilyn and Jim viewed David with not just with deserved professional respect, they seemed to love him as a kind of late adopted son. Except for Shirley and me, the rest of the Simons Foundation board was taken by surprise when Jim announced the succession. A long-serving board member, who may have had his own ambitions for the position, was brave enough to ask, "Shouldn't we engage a search firm and have an international search for so important a position before taking a vote?" "I don't think so," Jim said. The vote in favor was unanimous. Soon after the U.S. presidential election, Eric Lander called me with the news that he was going to be President Biden's science advisor, a fact to be kept secret. Eric invited me to send him a list of suggested PCAST co-chairs and members. I submitted a list of 20 excellent women and no men. I wanted to make the point, as unsubtly as possible, that Eric's personal reputation put him on shaky ground. The influential Me Too movement was calling out men for misogynistic behaviors. I tended to think of Eric as an equal opportunity bully, not biased toward women. But his ad hominem attacks on Jennifer Doudna in their institution's CRISPR patent dispute were noticed, and not just by scientists. There were said to be other skeletons in his closet. Deserved or not, the liabilities were there. I included Doudna on my proposed PCAST co-chair list with a prickly comment, "Nobelist, whether you approve or not." Including Doudna, I added, might be seen by the scientific community as an indication of his willingness to put scientific and personal differences aside in his new position. "You are more controversial than you might think, and this would help," I added. He wrote back, thanking me for my comments. In January, President Biden did announce the nomination of Eric Lander as his science advisor. Also announced was the choice of two PCAST co-chairs, Nobel laureate Francis Arnold and MIT Vice President Maria Zuber, both near the top of my list. Francis, by now a friend of some 30 years, called me a few weeks after that to invite me to be a PCAST member as, apart from Eric, the one renomination of an Obama PCAST member, a mark of how overloaded was the Biden White House with the pandemic and with cleaning up after Trump, it was September before the public announcement was made. In the press release, I was just another rank-and-file member, a professor in Texas somewhere, alphabetically under P. Still, my appointment was comforting evidence that I hadn't yet become entirely irrelevant. In the wake of COVID's isolation, that had some significance. Lander resigned, said to have been fired by Biden the following February. His bullying and mistreatment of subordinates, especially women, was stated as a reason. I was not too surprised. Mentally, I listed the ways that I was similar to and different from Eric. Both of us were, in the contemporary idiom, male, white, and privileged. He was a genius. I wasn't. But perhaps I was quicker to recognize an overdue societal reckoning. In that case, I thought I might still have a future.